We're going to talk about strategic givers today. We begin with stewardship. Now, this is a word that some of you have already mentioned. It's kind of a complicated word in English. So rather than try to define it, we are going to just talk about it for a few minutes. And maybe those of you who don't understand the word in English, you can quickly find the word in your own language. So somebody tell me their idea of stewardship. It's going to be an interactive time, by the way.
Like management.
Like management, okay. Stewardship is management, okay, that's good.
Is it more the leading or managing? Is it serving?
It's serving.
Others.
Serving others, okay. Managing, serving, those are good words. It can be a little bit more specific than that.
Maybe we should look into the Greek.
Okay, we have a Greek scholar in Dimitri. Since Bulgaria is kind of close to Greece, he can do that. Unfortunately, I'm not a Greek scholar. So.
What I've heard is that the description is crucial. Someone who's given something and he's overseeing it.
He's overseeing it.
Over something that is not his own.
That's it. Yeah, that's it. So a stewardship is somebody who's been given responsibility for something that he does not own.
Like an administrator.
A little bit like an administrator, a little administrator. In the West, we have trusts also, where somebody is given, entrusted with funds. The trust is a stewardship, a function of stewardship. Okay, so the concept of stewardship is very important. Why? Very basically.
To realize it's not ours.
So all of the resources that we have in our lives and our ministries, they don't belong to us. Who do they belong to? To God. Okay, so what does Scripture say about stewardship? That's a very important question. So who has a Bible and can read, who's comfortable reading in English? Maybe one, maybe our Scott or our Aussie can help us in Matthew 25.
For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling in a far country called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto them, and unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability and bravely to his journey. Then he that he received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made other 5 talents. And likewise he that had received two, he also gained other 2. But that he had received 1 went and digged in the earth, and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and reconnected with them. It is the old version.
Okay, that's all right.
It's okay.
Keep going.
And so he had received 5. He had received 5 talents. Came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained besides them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee a ruler over many, many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that he received 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other more talents beside them. His Lord said unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown and gathering where thou hast not strewed. And I was afraid and went and hid thy talent in the earth. His Lord answered and said unto him, Wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not stewed. Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchanger, and at my coming I should have received my own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him and give it unto him which had 10 talents. For unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken even that which he hath. And cast ye in the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Amen.
Amen. All right, so very familiar story, right? A ruler with a lot of money is going over to a foreign country. He gathers 3 servants and he gives them some talents, or in this case we can say money. It's probably easier to talk about it in terms of money. And he goes off. And then he comes back and he holds those servants' stewards account for what they have done with the master's money. Now, who of you have actually preached on this parable before? Okay, almost all of you have preached on it before. What were some of the themes that you gathered from it when you've preached about it in the past?
I think to me the most interesting, of course, everybody wants to ask the question, why is, in our minds, why is the master so unfair?
Right.
Why does he poor servant with 1 talent, he matches in.
Right.
I think it's always interesting to see how this servant with 1 talent basically depicts a very different, interesting picture of the master.
Yes.
He basically accuses him of being someone which he actually is not, in order to justify his lack of desire to have done what he should have, to be a servant. So I think that's
One of the themes from this parable that Victor has preached about is that last servant. He actually accuses the master of character that he doesn't really display, but he wants to use that as an excuse for his inaction. Okay, very good, interesting. What other themes? Dimitri, were you going to say something?
Well, for me, oftentimes we think about how much is a talent. It was a lot.
A talent was a lot, yes.
A lot. 1 talent, from what we read sometimes, it says it's 20 years' wages for a laborer.
Wow.
20 years is a lot. So,
it's a lot of money.
Yeah, it seems like God speaks to us that he gives us everything we need for a long period of time.
Okay.
In advance.
Yeah, very interesting.
Talents, gifts, whatever it is.
Right.
But for a long period of time. So it's not he gave it today, it'll be for a year.
Mm-hmm.
It's for a long period of time. We have everything given in advance.
Hmm.
It's in our, let's say, hands.
Okay.
Responsibility. What we're going to do for a long period of time with God's gifts that he's given.
Okay, good. So one of the themes Dimitri is saying is that actually this was quite a bit of money, especially the one who got 5 talents. That's a huge amount of money, probably more than any of us have ever been given. But the point is that it's a large amount of resources that we often are given for a long period of time. And so would you say that stewardship is a long-term character that we must have as Christians? Okay, good. Anything else?
Yeah. Yeah.
That
the master gave the servants the amount of talents that he knew that he can...
Very good, yes.
You know, he was so fair, he knew that, you know, every one of them had different ability.
Yep.
And then he gave them according to the ability to... He didn't pressurize any one of them.
That's right.
So because of the laziness of the other, the one that, you know, buried the talent,
yes,
and lack of interest in the, you know, for his master,
yes,
he didn't do anything with the talent.
So in that case, the master we know for sure was fair, going back to Victor's point, because he gave that third servant an amount that he knew that servant could invest and could reap a return. Very good. Very good. Anything else?
Well, he doesn't distribute evenly.
He doesn't distribute evenly. That's right. Very good.
Some more, some less.
I learned many years ago when I'm sharing the seminar with ministry leaders that everybody wants to preach a little bit, so I'm giving you the chance, you know, to tell me. We're going to talk about a piece of the parable that you may have never seen before. Now, before we talk about that, I want you to know I'm not saying this is the main point of the parable, okay? Because we know when we learn about hermeneutics that we have to be careful about the way we interpret parables, right? The main point of this parable really are the things that you've talked about. He who has been faithful in little, then the master can entrust with much. I think that is the main point of this parable. But I'm going to point out something to you before. Maybe you've never seen it before, because I think it's interesting about this whole question about stewardship and about fundraising. Let me begin by asking you a question. If you had to put yourself as a ministry leader, so as the leader of a new nonprofit, as the leader of a youth ministry, IFES, or the leader of a seminary Bible school in Moscow, if you had to put yourself in that role in this parable, what role do you think that you would have?
Which role?
There's a master. What other role is there?
There's a
master servant. Yeah. What would you put yourself in?
Not master.
Not master. Good. Congratulations. You're not the master. Are you the steward?
Yes, definitely.
Definitely? Okay. Is there another role in this parable?
Bankers.
Ah, look at verse 27. Somebody else read verse 27. Cully, could you read verse 27?
Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest.
Uh-huh. Now see, I think what we've missed about this parable is this third role of the banker. Now, it's only mentioned one time, so that's why I think we have to be careful with it. But I do think it's a legitimate role in the kingdom. I think we as ministry leaders in this context are the bankers. The donors, the givers that you are looking for, they are the stewards. And the master is still the master. Mm-hmm. But it's important for you to realize that you are not a steward because you have not necessarily been given large amounts of money or large amounts of resources. This is what makes Dimitri's point very, very interesting. One of the things that distinguishes these stewards is they have been given large amounts of money. How many of you have been given large amounts of money? I haven't. Very few of us probably have. I think our role, if we think in terms of the parable at least, is the role of the banker. The role of the banker is to help the steward return on the investment for the master. Now think about the implications of that. Who is held accountable at the end of the parable? The stewards, not the bankers. People say, well, why can't I just go to a giver and convince him that he needs to give money for my, even though my ministry is small, give me the money because I'm going to do a great thing with it. Well, he wants all these reports and he wants all these statistics and he wants all of this information about what I'm doing with his money. Why? Because he's thinking as a steward. And that's what you see with strategic givers. And it's important for you all to understand that, because here's another implication of that. Do the bankers need the stewards? Yeah. Do the stewards need the bankers? Yeah. You see, people look at me sometimes because I represent a foundation in the United States, they think of me as the master. The guy with all the money is the master. Not true. The guy with the money is the steward. And I need the banker, just like the banker needs me. The master is the master. If Dimitri asks my foundation for a grant, then we are together. We're trying to make a return for the master. We're in it. We're in the ministry together, is the point. So again, it's not the primary point of the parable, but I think it's something to think about as you approach this whole idea of strategic givers. How many of you had thought of that before? I hadn't either until a few years ago. But it can be very freeing, I think, when you think about the implications of it. Okay. Fundraising is ministry. True or false?
It is.
It's true. But we have a tendency to think false, right? I have to do fundraising so I can go do the ministry. We have a separation in our minds between fundraising is just the, I have to do it. I have this great vision to reach, Romania or Bulgaria, whatever it is. but I have to go find the donors to give me the money so I can go do what God has called me to do. Oops. That's not the New Testament pattern. Remember when Jesus sends out his disciples, the first time he sends them out, he says what? Don't take a staff or a bag, or just go find a man of peace, stay there, your needs will be taken care of. Next time he sends them out, what does he say this time? Take everything with you. Now, why the difference? I don't actually know the difference, but what I can tell you is that's an important piece. There was a reason that Jesus said, don't go with any of your own resources the first time. The second time, go with resources. Why? Because resources were an important part of the ministry. Early in their ministry, they didn't do any fundraising, or they didn't have any resources. Jesus wanted them to go just with the power of the Holy Spirit. Just find some place to stay with. And if people aren't going to be hospitable to you, leave them alone. Go somewhere you can find hospitality. Later, he says, take the resources with you. Resources are important. Resources are part of the ministry. Some years ago, I had the leader of a ministry that's based in the U.S. that's doing ministry throughout the world was in our office, and I knew him in a previous role. So I knew him when I was leading the ministry as well. We were more colleagues and peers. But now he was at our foundation asking for some money. And we had a break time, and some of the people left, and so he and I were just catching up personally because we'd known each other for many years. And he said, hey, Lee, our ministry is thinking about hiring a fundraiser. We call them development directors. Our ministry, but basically it's a fundraiser. And I said, oh, really? Why do you want to hire somebody to raise funds for you? And he said, well, I'm very busy leading, and the guys in the field are very busy doing the ministry. We don't have time for fundraising. And I thought, oh, no. I said, why do you think that fundraising isn't ministry? And so we ended up having about a half an hour talk about, now, I'm not saying there isn't a role for people who focus on raising resources for your ministry, but those people need to be just as engaged in ministry and understanding of ministry as the people who are actually in the field doing it. In fact, people who are raising funds, that's their role, they need to be in the field doing ministry themselves so they can understand what it's all about. As the representative of a foundation, I don't like talking with development directors or professional fundraisers because I want to talk to the people who are doing the ministry in the field. That's where I get the information that I have. So this is a very important thing for you to understand. And it's good. The reason it's going to be as important is because later we're going to talk about how much time you should be doing fundraising. And you're going to say, oh, that's too much because I've got ministry to do. Oops. If you think of it as not ministry, then of course you won't want to spend your time doing it. Okay. Questions? Challenges so far? Okay. Good. All right. Next thing to understand, people give for different reasons. Your givers, are they relational or strategic? Now, here's the difference that Dimitri mentioned in his introduction. You're actually going to find out that not much of the content has changed, Dimitri, from 2 years ago, so you might be disappointed. If you get up and leave, I won't be offended. This is a very important distinction. People give for reasons. There's actually a book, I can't remember the name of it offhand, but it describes seven different reasons people give. I'm just going to talk about two of them today. Relational givers versus strategic givers. We've already talked a little bit about relational givers, those who are giving as stewards because they want a kingdom return on the investment that they've given. A relational giver is somebody who gives why?
Because
they know you, because they love you, because they have a relationship with you. I used to be a support raising missionary, lived here in Europe, and I raised support. Most of the people who gave support to my ministry didn't have any idea what I was doing, honestly. I'd try to get them to ask questions, but they really didn't understand it. They gave because they knew me, actually because they knew and loved my wife. That was kind of the great thing about it. So it doesn't have to be you. If you're not a lovable person, hopefully you've married somebody who is. People give because they know you and they love you. Or they can also have a passion for something that you're engaged in. So if somebody has a passion for university ministry, I consider that still a relational giver because they don't necessarily need to know exactly how you're going to be, you know, doing your ministry. What is it again, Victor, yours does?
I'm litigating off oftentimes. Religious freedom.
Right, religious freedom, that's a great example. People know that religious freedom is an issue. They might not know exactly what the issues are in Southern Europe, but because they may not follow you into the courtroom and try to figure out your strategies and what you're doing, but because they have a passion for religious liberty, they will give to that. Or, Cully, this is a very good example, because they have a passion for Christians and arts. And I think you'll find that that's true more and more, especially as people from strategic givers from the U.S. Now, do you have to have both? Relational and strategic givers.
Yeah,
you have to have both. And in fact, you probably need to have the majority of your givers be relational. Why is that?
Stay longer.
They stay longer. They will give to you through thick and thin, we say in English, because they love you. So if your ministry is going through hard times and there's not a lot of reaping going on, you need to have people who are giving because they're committed to you or they're committed to your ministry. I usually tell people that at least 60%, 65, 70% of your support should come from relational donors. Let me give you another example. I had a friend who was raising money to be a missionary overseas, and there was somebody in his network, a very wealthy guy, who heard about what he was doing, and he said, "I want to give you $1,000 a month to do your ministry." Now, at that time, this was years ago, this was back in the 90s, $1,000 a month, it's still a big deal, but it was even a bigger deal then. And the question he had to decide was whether he should take that money or not. This was a strategic donor who wanted to give the money because he believed in what the guy was doing and it would have a big impact. Now, that seems like the answer to that question seems pretty easy, right? Well, take the $1,000 a month, right, and go. Well, the problem was that was about 25% of his budget. What happened if that guy decided to stop giving? Oops. He's got to get back to the U.S. and he's got to raise 25% more because he just lost in one person. So you have to be very careful not to become dependent on a single source of revenue for your ministry. And that's why relational donors are very, very important. Okay. Let me ask you a question. Who of you have a good base of relational donors already for your ministry? Okay, so can you just give me approximately what percentage they're providing?
57.
Approximately 57.35725%. Good. Okay. You just had your board meeting. Okay, 57. All right, so Vladimir, you need to do more work on that. It's not, in my opinion, strategic donors, you have to have them, but you need to get that relational piece up to 65-70%, in my opinion. Who else? Cully, you said?
80%.
About how much? 80%. Okay, 80. So you're in a very good position because you can actually expand. You're in a position now where you can actually expand your donor base by plugging into some strategic donors. And you can actually maybe even back away a little bit from the ministry, from the day-to-day ministry, to be able to focus on strategic donors.
It's 80%
of the people,
yeah.
But it's not 80% of the budget. Okay, yeah. So you have a lot. You have a lot of work to do as well. Okay, good. Victor, what was yours percentage?
Yeah, probably the same as Scully.
Okay, okay. I find that most European leaders are in that position. There's nothing wrong with being in that position. Most organizations have to begin with relational donors because strategic donors won't typically invest. This is getting to your problem in a minute, Victor. It won't typically invest in kind of a startup ministry. Okay. All right, let's start talking about these strategic givers practically. All right, strategic givers, they want to be investors, not donors. Now, we've been talking about being givers. I like the word giver better than donor, because donor makes me sound like I'm, in English, I'm going to be giving you my kidney or something, you know. So they want to be investors, or at least givers, not donors. And they want to be partners, not owners. What happens if that same guy who was going to give 25% of my friend's support, what happens if he got disenchanted? What happens if he got frustrated or he didn't like the ministry anymore and he pulled away his funds? Well, then he would feel bad. My friend would feel bad. It would be a very uncomfortable feeling for everyone. lots of strategic givers have been in that situation before where they've given too much at the wrong time and they've been burned and they've been very unhappy. So if you go to a strategic donor and you say, I want €1 million this year, well, don't be disappointed if they say no. Give them some different levels. Say, here's what we could accomplish if we had €5,000. Here's what we could accomplish if we had €20,000. And here's what we could accomish if we had €100,000. Now, €100,000 for most strategic donors, I mean, I represent a fairly sizable foundation. $100,000 is a big amount even for me, even for our foundation. I mean, I'm only going to give in Europe only 2 grants over $100,000 this year. It's much more common, especially at the beginning of a relationship, even for a strategic donor, for them to give smaller amounts. But every once in a while, God will surprise you with a €25,000 or a €50,000 gift. You have to give people vision and opportunity for something that big, but don't expect them to do it right off the bat because they don't want to own you. They want to be your partner. Okay? Does it make sense? Okay. Let's see. Sorry, I moved back one. Okay. They like to fund projects. Rarely will they give funds for operations. What do I mean by operations there?
Day-to-day activities?
Day-to, yeah.
Well, salaries, payroll.
Salaries, yeah. Light bill, yeah. Rent, yeah. Transportation.
Leasing.
Yeah. Now, who's the best giver for that kind of operations?
Local
and relational, right? Relational people are giving because they love you and they love what you're doing. So if you say, hey, man, we need €600 a month for rent. Can you help us with that? Of course, because I love you and I want you to be successful. A strategic donor probably won't do that because he or she will ask the question, well, what happens when I stop giving the money for the rent? They want to give to something that has a beginning and a middle and an end, a project that they can look at and say, this project was successful, or this project wasn't successful, and here's what we need to do differently. They need to have something that they can wrap their minds around and hearts around in kind of a chunk. Okay? So, yeah, go ahead, Victor.
Wouldn't that be a little bit sort of artificial division sometimes? Because how do you divide operations from a project?
Right.
Because a project might involve exactly such expenses.
Of course, yes. Very good question. So Victor is saying, but the separation between operations and projects is sometimes difficult to make. Absolutely right. So if I have a personal assistant, a secretary, and I've got operations and I've got 5 different projects are going on, how do I know that secretary is just supporting me? Or the rent is for all the projects, right? So there's nothing wrong with having overhead by project. So if you have €600 a month rent, divide that over the projects and say, well, right now 60% of our time is going for this project, so we allocate a portion of our office rent to that. So donors are not afraid to give to overhead, but they want a reasonable allocation of that overhead to the project. They just don't want to have to write a check or send a bank transfer for €600 every month just for your rent.
People that get involved.
That's right. So Dimitri's just given an example of how he did that recently for a church. Was it a U.S. church? It was a U.S. church asking for a project budget, knowing that there would be overhead expenses including in that. Now, to the degree that you have a project manager or specific people who are assigned only to that project, that really helps you in fundraising because you can say, what I have trained my grantees to put in is, instead of salaries, staff coordination. Because they know that a project needs to be coordinated, right? So nobody's afraid. So if there's an art show coming up that your graduates are doing, you have to have a, whatever that word is, a show manager or whatever, that you can put in straight in there. Because they know they're not funding that woman's salary or man's salary forever, but for the period of that project. Okay? Questions about that? I may not be able to give specific examples for every one of your ministries, but what I'm hoping to do is give you concepts that you can take back and apply to your specific context. Okay, this is a really important one. They desire accountability, not possibility. Now, the challenge that you have with many young ministries is that you're talking about possibility. So Victor is saying, I want to see complete religious freedom in Bulgaria.
I need to insert one explanation, though. We've been in the field for 10 years.
You've been doing it for 10 years.
A lot of stuff to show.
Good, good, so excellent.
We're not a startup, exactly.
Good,
the
good.
The issue is that how can we catch up with the, whatever we have in terms of ministry, how can we boost it?
You're right, good.
That's,
so I'm using you as an example, maybe not the best one. Yes, sure. So I should make a... For the recording, Victor is actually much farther along than I'm giving credit for. This is a really difficult challenge for a ministry that's new because you have all kinds of possibilities in mind. I want to see university students, one in Hungary. I want to see, you know, art shows throughout Scotland that display Christian artists. Whatever it is, you have a big possibility. And the strategic donor says, well, wait a second, what's going to happen in the next 6 months? And it's a much easier question to answer about the 10-year future, right, than it is what's going to happen in the next six months. But why is a strategic donor asking that? Because of the parable. Because if they're going to give you 20,000 euro, they want to know what the show is going to do, or what's yours again, your ministry? Pastor of Calvary Chapel, okay. So... what is Calvary Chapel going to look different? So you can give a vision for Calvary Chapel in your city in Serbia 10 years from now, but it's difficult to know what those incremental steps are. So accountability to shorter-term goals is very, very important. They have to have the vision, but you have to be able to break it down for a strategic donor. Okay, yeah, go back. Sure.
Cut my...
right. Okay, this is a really, really great point. Really good. So David is saying he's the pastor of which is your church? Which denomination is it?
It's a free.
Okay, it's independent evangelical church in Budapest.
Yes.
And so a church in the U.S. found him, and they came to him and wanted to give him. Can you tell me the amount of money they were wanting to give?
More than $10,000.
Okay, let's say $10,000. But along with that $10,000. They had a contract, a written contract,
yes,
that they wanted you to sign about what you would do. Okay.
I did.
So you did. Okay. Now, so can we take this stewardship thing a little too far? And I think the answer is yes, absolutely. And the point that David was making was that he was very scared to sign that contract because he didn't know if he could really abide by the terms of the contract and give it. So here's the other news. You don't have to say yes to every steward that comes along. Who do you have to say yes to? The master. Okay? So the banker gets to say to the steward, no, I'm not going to take your money because I cannot give you the return that you desire. We're stretching the parable a little bit, but just for illustration purposes, if the steward came to the banker and said, okay, and here are my 5 talents and I want to get 15 back, the banker can say, no, I can't do that. You know, so that's another way. It's another reason why those roles are so important, because you can't say no to the master, right? So then it becomes a question for you as the banker. What does the master want? Mm-hmm. Now, you did go ahead and receive the money,
yes,
and you signed the contract.
Yes, but we had to speak it through.
You had to talk about it, yeah?
We decreased the
okay.
The
okay, good.
Because I said that this is just unrealistic.
Yes, okay. Great. Another great example. So David, as the banker, he negotiated with the steward, right? Because they need each other. Mm-hmm. That church wants to give money away. They saw what you were doing in Budapest and they said, we want to be part of that. Now that's a healthy relationship. If you're thinking of them as the master and they get to make all the decisions, you're out of balance. Okay. So I want to say good for you, David. The fact that it made you a little bit nervous means that you're relying on the Spirit, not on some big church in the U.S. Good for you. That's a good lesson for everyone. Okay. Strategic donors typically understand leverage. Now, what do I mean by leverage? If you have finance people in the room, they're going to think of leverage as debt. I don't mean that kind of debt. In finance, people use leverage to increase their return. If I can invest somebody else's money, have you ever heard this phrase, somebody else's money? If I can invest somebody else's money, then I can increase the return on investment. In this case, in leverage, I It's not a financial term as much as it is a term of the way the kingdom works. If I want to see, I'm going to come back to you, Cully. I'm not sure if it's, so any of these examples could not be accurate. I'm just using them as examples. If you wanted to have art shows, let's say it's visual arts or maybe even performance art, you wanted to have art shows around the UK highlighting the work of Christian artists so that people could see, and this was your big vision, is it possible that God has given that vision to somebody else? Right, of course. So my point is that anyone, any vision that you have, you're not the only one that has it. Probably. So a very important thing for you as a banker, for the steward, is to understand what God's larger kingdom purpose might be in mobilizing artists for the UK or for Europe or whatever it is, and see what you can get done together with them whom God has similarly called. It's not about what you can do. It's about what you can see get done. Now, this is where we, especially the further west you go, and Americans are the worst, probably the Brits and the Scots are really bad, really not quite as bad, but the further east we go, this tends to be less of an issue. But the further west you go, it's all about what I can do. Not invent it here. If I didn't invent it, then it's not good, or that it can't be used. Our egos get in the way, our methods get in the way. When actually, when a strategic donor wants to hear is, I'm engaged with university students in Hungary, and there are these five other ministries that are doing the same thing. And with your funds, I can't get along with two of them, I've tried, but with three other ones, we have made a partnership. And we're going to cooperate together to reach, you know, the finance university or the history university, whatever it is in Budapest. So whatever your vision is, recognize that you can't do it yourself. And then think about the way that you can leverage the gifts and talents of other people. You know, there's a group in the U.S. called International Justice Mission.
Yes,
you're familiar with IJM. And so IJM is this great story of this American attorney. He was working for the State Department. And he went into Rwanda after the genocide there in 94. And he was hired by the UN to go there and to document the stories of the genocide. And his heart was breaking the whole time he was there because he realized that attorneys and investigators and all kinds of people with the kinds of skills that, I mean, there was just this massive need. Well, as a result of that time in Rwanda, God gave him a vision for this international justice mission. He's got now former FBI agents, former U.S. attorneys, private investigators. He's mobilized all these really, really smart people around this vision of rescuing people who are in bondage around the world. And they go, especially in Asia and Africa, they have projects where they're rescuing children out of child prostitution. If he had only been one man and said, what can I do, and a few of my friends, he would have never realized the vision. But he wanted to leverage all of this expertise that was already there. So think about leveraging things that you think about, whether it's existing professors or whether it's existing artists or whether it's existing attorneys. Try to figure out what's already out there that you can leverage so you're not relying on your own resources. And if you can describe that to a strategic donor, that's really that can really get them excited. That make sense? Okay, let's talk about the giver. Let's talk about some questions for the giver himself. What areas does the giver like to invest in? What is their giving strategy? So a lot of times these strategic donors will actually have a giving strategy. Not all of them, but some of them do. I was in Central Asia a number of years ago. I was in Kazakhstan, or Kyrgyzstan, I think. And I got invited to a dinner with some local ministry leaders. And this guy grabs me kind of by the arm when I get in. You know, first you take off your shoes. But then he kind of grabs me and he kind of takes me in. And so we're kind of having a big discussion. But then he's constantly trying to want to get my ear. You know, he's constantly trying to want to tell me something, because he knows that I represent a foundation in the U.S. So finally, we get some time alone, and I mean without taking a breath. He's telling me all about his ministry and how they want to do this hospital and how. And at the end, I had to say, man, that sounds great, but our foundation doesn't invest in hospitals. And if he would just ask a question, even one of his buddies, you know, who maybe knew, do you know anything about that foundation and what they invest in? Now, it seems simple that you would ask that, But that's a big mistake. People just plow in when they get an opportunity to talk to a strategic giver. They think, man, if I could just tell him as fast as I can, he's going to give. But actually, that strategy almost never works. It's much better to listen about what's on the heart of a strategic giver, because he's a steward. That's really important. What do they like to give to? What has God given them a burden to? Okay, does the giver like pioneering efforts? Or does the giver prefer to accelerate proven strategies? So typically, a strategic giver is going to want to do the second one. We say, well, then I don't have access to strategic givers because what I'm doing is new. Okay, well, maybe not everything that you're doing is new. Maybe you have a new project, but you also have some existing projects that have already shown to be effective. Then go ahead and get the strategic givers engaged in what you're doing that's already successful. So if you want to start a scholarship program for, you know, artists, well, maybe that's kind of a new thing. You don't know how that's going to go, but you've done these shows and, you know, they're already showing. So whatever the example is in your context, find something the strategic donor can invest in that's already working. Oops, sorry. Okay, what expertise does the giver have? Can they offer you something other than money? IT services. That's the one that comes to mind because I know of a specific example where instead of giving money, a donor actually sent some IT, some smart internet technology people to the place, and they set up a computer network for this ministry. I thought that was a really good idea. They didn't have to spend any money. They didn't have to write a $50,000 check, but what they gave them in time and resources was worth a lot of money. So
sometimes it could be just networking, you know, putting you in contact with other people.
Right. So Cully's point is sometimes a strategic donor, if they can't give you money, they can put you in touch with somebody potentially who can. So that's a great, we're going to talk about that actually in a few minutes when we talk about finding them.
May I return to the previous?
Sure. Yeah, of course.
What do you think? There are more givers who like to be pioneering, to take pioneering before?
Yeah.
Or the other one?
The other one. Yeah.
Do you think this?
They like to give more to the existing ones. Yeah, to accelerate existing strategies, for sure.
Is it because some of them, they don't believe in the vision of the steward?
Yeah, no, it's not because they don't believe in the vision. It's just that they're cautious at first, especially with a new ministry. So, like, if I have a grantee, who is doing work in Czech? What's your name again?
Vladimir.
Oh, I called you Vladimir. Sorry. Vladimir, which organization are you working with in Czech?
Josiah
Venture. Okay. So this is a very good example of it. Josiah Venture is a very well-established youth training ministry in Central Europe, started in Czech Republic. If you have a chance, if you're interested in youth ministry, you have a chance to meet Dave Patty or some of his staff. Really, really great ministry. And our foundation invested some years ago in the Exit 316 project. Mm-hmm. Exit 316 was a television program that Josiah Venture produced with some other Czech Christians, and they put it on television on one of the state, the public television channels, and several hundred thousand students got to see it over a period of the season. They began with 14 episodes, and then they asked them to do 28, and then I forget the numbers, but it went three times. Now, we invested in that. That was a high risk venture, because nobody could tell you whether Exit 316 program was going to work or not. But the reason we invested in it is because Josiah Venture had a history of effective ministry in Czech Republic. They had been in Czech Republic since the early 90s. So something about the ministry has to be established, I think, before a strategic donor will invest in it. It doesn't mean they won't invest in a new project, but they have to have confidence, because they're thinking as a steward, in what God has already done.
So that applies to proven strategies within your own organization, not proven strategies over there that you are...
Well, okay. Yeah, so tell me your first name again.
Peter.
Okay, so Peter had a good question. What if we're investing, I think what you're saying is, what if our ministry is investing in a strategy that's new for us, but it's been proven that it works in other contexts or by other. Yeah, that's possible. So the degree that you can describe the success or the effectiveness in another context or by another ministry and how you're going to use those same principles in a new context, absolutely. Yeah. You may still need to start with some relational donors on that, but it's possible. Yeah. I think, especially if the strategic donor has a history of granting to that kind of thing. So now I can say, so somebody else comes to me and says, we're going to do a television show in Vietnam. I can say, oh, well, all right, I've got some experience with television shows. And then I go back and I look at my notes and say, okay, what was it that made Exit 316 effective? And does any of that apply to Vietnam? I don't know. But then the strategic donor will have some background. That's why it's important to know what they're interested in to begin with.
I was asking you that question because the middle one. Because the beginning is very, very, very hard for everyone.
Yes. Yes, it is.
So my problem is that they don't want to, I mean, the strategic giver.
Yeah.
They don't want to, or they don't like, let's say, to give for the beginning foundation. When this is the hardest thing for those who...
It's relational donors. Almost always relational donors have to begin. They have to begin a ministry.
To count on them at least for the beginning.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like that. They just, from our experience, we have to work on a lot of personal relationships. Even with strategic donors, sometimes it's somebody you know that he knows, and he knows somebody at this strategic organization that will, let's say, recommend you.
Yeah.
So it's always working with individuals and groups that know you.
I think also it helps to, if it's from God, it will survive. So even though the beginnings are hard, if you don't make it, then it's not from God. So who cares to invest in you? So I think that makes sense.
It
may sound like, harsh and kind of business-like.
Well, it's in the parable. Because the parable says the master gave resources according to their abilities. Now, we're going to talk about this in a minute, about capacity for leadership and capacity. You have to work within the capacity that God has given you. And sometimes a ministry will fail because, in my opinion, because the leaders have worked beyond the capacity that God has given them. Their vision has become too big, beyond their capacity. I've seen in a couple of instances where founders of ministries will actually step down. It takes a lot of humility. But the founder of a ministry will actually step down and give the leadership of the ministry to someone else. Have you ever seen that happen? What I think is happening there is that originating leader is knowing that he or she does not have the capacity to take it to the next level. And that's sometimes the wisest thing you can do as a ministry leader, is to step aside and have somebody. Because the master is not going to give you resources beyond the ability that you have.
Is it a bad thing for the strategic giver to know and to realize that they are strategic givers for us?
No. Great. Yeah, that's a great point. Sometimes strategic givers don't realize that they are strategic givers. They're uncomfortable because, this is a great point, they're uncomfortable giving the way they've been asked to be given. They're uncomfortable with the proposals that they receive because they feel like they should just be giving because somebody asks. But you can help them understand the role of a strategic giver, and if you can do that, that's really good because then you can show them how your ministry is strategic. If you give them permission to give in a way that they've never given before, that's great, because then they'll want to give to you. That's a great point.
Because I'm not sure that they feel comfortable knowing that they are strategic.
Maybe not.
That's why I'm asking you.
You can share the parable with them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We're trying to know them better. Some of them, they don't want to know us, to have a relationship.
They don't want to have a relationship with you.
Some of them.
Yeah.
It's something like that. They won't,
that's tough.
They operate like a business.
Yep.
They're very business-like. Right. Mm-hmm. They look at you as a project, not part of the business. They don't start any personal relationships. I've had an organization like that for where our supporters for 2 or 3 years, and then they said our priorities have changed. The budget has, has dropped considerably over the last 3 years, so
yes.
We have to pitch. I say, okay, you know, because I know they work like that. There's no personal relationship involved. But that's what the pitching does. This kind of business life in town.
They want to share with you any specific things.
No, no, it's just, this is the way they operate.
Yeah.
The American donors, they're somewhere out there, so.
You know. Now, right. It can be overdone, by the way. The whole strategic donor thing can be, it can become annoying, right? How much reports you have to fill out and, and people will cut you off because, their budget. So when you venture into this realm of strategic givers, the point is it's not always going to be easy. But I think it's still important. So be prepared to kind of, to have a good relationship with them for a while and maybe not afterwards because
also,
something has changed.
Another great point as well, they're cutting us off, but thank you very much for the years that you've been giving.
Well, of course. Yes,
years,
God provided for them.
Thank God. It's happened and God has blessed us. Thank God. You say thank you and God bless you.
Yes. And if you treat them with respect and love, they may come back when there's another opportunity.
Just thank him for the years.
All right. We're going to keep moving. So stop me anytime if you have questions. These are all great questions, by the way. You're a very good class. Okay, let me give you, this is going to go back to the question of do they know whether they're strategic givers or not. This will give you an idea of what the old view of a donor was versus a strategic giver today. Old view and approach, new view and approach. Okay, so they see themselves as a donor. But the new ones see themselves as investors. Now, by the way, if you're uncomfortable with business terminology, I understand that. There is a point where sometimes you may even have to say to a strategic donor, by the way, this is not a business. This is a ministry. Okay? But to the degree that business terms are used in Scripture, like they are in the parable of the talents, we have to recognize that there is this aspect of return for the kingdom. So my point in using business terms is not to say that ministry is a business, but my point is to say that business concepts are used in Scripture sometimes in describing ministry. Is that okay? Okay. If you don't like it, well, there, you won't be the first one. Okay. The old donors were isolated. The new strategic givers are connected and networked. They're not going to get information just from what you tell them. If you have a Facebook page, they're going to go on your Facebook page. If they know another artist in the UK, they're going to say, hey, what's the deal with this Scully guy? Cully, what's his name? Colin? Yeah. They're going to find, especially if you're asking them for a significant gift, they're going to figure out a way to get some more information about you.
I have an experience on that.
Okay, have some experience on that?
And we began another fellowship in one village.
Yep.
So we needed a building there. So then we just, in newsletters, we just ask for people to donate. Somebody, one guy from Canada knew my co-worker, so they met, and then he was interested. So he came to visit us, and then he went to another town called Novi Sad, to see some. So he asked about us.
Sure.
They really give good comments upon us, and they are great guys, and they come here to help us, and then that really encouraged him to really give so that we can buy the building.
Good. So in Serbia, that's a place where most of the Christians know the other Christians, right? There's not very many Christian leaders in Serbia, so it's important for you to have good relationships with the people who are working in your context, in your field, in your country, in the case of Serbia, where there are very few Christian leaders, because people will find other ways to find out about you. It's good. Good example. So the old approach was content with activities and outputs. Okay, so our activity is we're going to train some people. And the output is we're going to have trained people. Ministry I was with, we trained church planters. And one of our goals was to train as many church planters as we possibly could. And that was great for our old donors. But our new, we're going to talk a lot about this in a minute, our new givers were focused on outcomes. They were not outputs, but outcomes on results. Fruits. Yeah, fruit would be a good biblical term.
A very specific understanding on both sides what the outcome.
That's right. Very good. Yeah, so Victor's saying you have to be very clear up front what you expect the outcomes to be. Absolutely true. And this is why David was so nervous at the beginning when he got that investment, because he didn't know whether the outcomes they wanted could actually be produced. But here's the point, guys. Don't be frustrated that they want to know about the outcomes. Why do they want to know about the outcomes? Because they're stewards. If I go to the banker, if I'm a steward and I go to the banker and I say, here's some money, what kind of return can you give me? The banker goes, well, you know, we're going to invest it here and we might give a loan here, and but we're going to do a lot of activity with your money, but I can't guarantee you anything, you know, maybe zero return. You maybe we'll just take your money. You know, that's not, doesn't give that, that's not an equal playing field, right, between banker and steward. So don't be offended when they ask you for fruit. Okay? It's really important. Okay. It used to be a donor would just give the money and they weren't responsible for the results. Now they themselves, we've talked about this, feel accountable for the results as stewards. They used to be content to do good. Now they want to make a difference. If you want, now there's, okay, there is no magic. I cannot give you, in English we say, a silver bullet. You know, have you ever heard this phrase, a silver bullet? I cannot give you a magic phrase, abracadabra, and the money will come in. But I can tell you, if there are words that you want to use when you're talking to a strategic donor, say, this is how you can make a difference. There are no magic words, but that's as close as I can get you to them. Here's how you can make a difference, because that's what strategic donors want. They want to be good stewards, and they want to know that they can make a difference. My boss says that all the time, by the way. When I'm presenting a grant, are we really making a difference by doing this project? So I'm prepared, man, because I know that question is coming. You're right. Well, this is a secret inside scoop. I don't tell everybody this. So. No. Yeah, right. If everybody uses that phrase, it will become overused, of course. But I'm telling you, it's a mindset more than a phrase. It's a good phrase, but it's more of a mindset, because you, as the banker, you want to help them be a good steward for the master. So you're saying to them, we're going to make a return together so that the master is pleased. The point is, people are not just content with your activities. They want to know what those activities will produce. Okay, so under the old paradigm, the ministry, you as the ministry leader, would just give the information and the donor may or may not be happy with it. Today, the donor is getting information from multiple sources. It's really important, because the internet has lots and lots. So check your facts. You know, when you're writing a proposal and you say, you know, 90% of Hungarian university students have never heard the name of Jesus. Well, I doubt that. Make sure if you've got a fact, that you've got a way to back it up. Because the donor, if you give a fact as a fact, the donor will check it. Because it goes to your credibility, whether you're making things up or not. I've got another comment about that, but I better not do it on the recording. The donor... the old paradigm was the donor passively observes. The new paradigm is the investor or strategic giver actively engages. So the old approach, a donor would wait until they'd retired and they had a pot of money that God had given them, and then they would start, you know, at age 65 giving it away. Today, strategic givers give throughout their lives. So what's the implication of that?
Well, look for younger donors.
But for younger donors, that's one. Yep, good. What about the amounts? Will that have an implication for the amount that they'll give?
Yeah, they're going to be smaller amounts.
Smaller amounts, that's right.
Consistently.
But potentially more frequent. Yep. Yep, that's right. Good. Dimitri, why don't you just come up and finish teaching? Okay.
See, between these two, the old and the new, is it actually the old, no one's doing that anymore, or is the...
No, fair enough. Yeah, no. This is not zero, it was 100, and there's a transition coming. So some of the, you know, in the UK, like we have good relationships, our foundation with the Lang Trust, and Keith Bentley actually comes around to the ELF from time to time. And no, that's a mostly brethren group. And so, I mean, I'm guessing for the recording, I can't say this, but my guess is they would see themselves much more from the old paradigm than the new. And actually, even the foundation that I come from, even though I talk about these shifts happening, there are still quite a number of those things that, I guess we've made the transition pretty much, but there are still quite a number of institutional givers, okay? So institutional givers are a subset of strategic givers, and the institutional givers, foundations, trusts, large families, they will tend to be more... a good example would be... it's changing, but the Lego family, the Danish family that has the Lego, so they are Christians. I don't know exactly how evangelical they are, but they give to Christian causes, especially in Denmark. I have friends who are ministry leaders there who get money from the Legos Foundation. And it seems like my experience is that it's much more traditional in the way that it gives. So the shift is not complete.
They have the foundation in the U.S., Lego?
Lego? No, it's in Denmark. Yeah, I don't know if it's... I don't know exactly what the legal structure is. I actually know very little about it, other than we have some common grantees. So I've given a grant to a couple of ministries in Scandinavia that the Lego Foundation has also given to. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. How close are we to our break? Would it be okay? Okay. Would it be okay if we took the break now?
Yeah.
Yes.
Because I think we've talked, and this is going to get fairly detailed, and so. The coffee may not be ready yet. Okay.
So,
yeah, sure, of course.
Is it part of the old paradigm that you approach a foundation rather than, say, with a project, that you would seek partial funding from a number of foundations today?
That would probably operate under both paradigms, but I would say that... yes, even under the old paradigm, I wouldn't necessarily give 100% of the project funds. You would still need to, so from the steward side, from the side of the ministry leader, you would definitely want to be thinking of more than one funder. We'll ask in our grant application, we'll ask for your top 10 donors. We want to know who else, and specifically if you already have funding for a project, we want to know who the other funders are. Because that helps us know, if I see a name there that I recognize, I'll say, oh, that's good that so-and-so is funding that. So I want you to write down four letters. The first one is N, the second one is I, the third one is S, and the fourth one is O, NISO. If you don't have a strategic plan for your ministry, I want to suggest this to you as a strategic planning tool that makes sense to a strategic giver, to a steward. Okay. Now, you may have your own documents and vision, and that's probably fine. But if you don't have one, I would recommend that you think about this one. So you begin with the need. What is it? What need are we trying to meet with the project that we are proposing to a strategic giver? Okay, so the need is university students. Sorry, I keep bugging you, David. University students that are unreached in Hungary and Budapest, we need to reach them. Our idea is to do what to meet the need? We need 10 more staff people, or we need to do open-air evangelism, or we need to recruit some Christian professors to go, whatever your idea is to reach that need. Then your strategy. How is it that you are going to execute on that idea? And then finally, the organizational capacity. Do we have the capacity we need in our organization to execute the strategy that will go around the idea that will meet the need? The idea is what we want to do to meet the need. The strategy is how we're going to execute the idea to meet the need, if it makes sense. A strategy is a little bit like a plan, but a plan is actually something that's more specific, that actually is kind of a combination of the idea and the strategy. Don't get too caught up in the words. Just understand the concepts. So these come down, but need and the idea form a vision. The idea and the strategy form a plan. A strategy and an organizational capacity form the execution, is kind of the way to think about it. Now, this whole idea of organizational capacity is important. Remember we talked about the steward, how the master gives resources according to the ability of the steward, right? What happens when an organization is young, and it's okay to be this, just recognize that you are, is that we have a very, very big idea, very, very big need, huge vision that we want to accomplish. We have an idea that probably doesn't quite meet the need, and then we have a strategy that probably doesn't quite execute the idea to meet the need, and finally, you know, it's just me and my dog that's trying to do it, right? So we're pretty short on capacity. Understand that if you're in this situation, you have to be very careful about what you communicate as the need and idea. You may want to reach all of the university students in Hungary, but if it's just you and your wife, you better just start with one institute, right? So it's okay to paint a big vision if at the same time you understand that more organizational capacity is needed to do it. Now, what you do in this situation is you can focus your grant request on organizational capacity. If we had more people, or if we had more this, we would have a better, our circles would be, you know, sort of in balance. Now, what happens with a mature organization? So for example, Josiah Venture, I would put in this category. Not that they're doing this, but this is the risk for, is that the pyramid gets flipped upside down. Over time, what happens is the organization gets really, really big, and most of the capacity of the organization is spent on keeping the organization going, and over time, the vision gets lost. So it's best to have these things sort of in balance, the way you see them there. And this gives a way for a strategic donor. I'll give you another example when we do an exercise of the sections that you can put in a proposal. But if you want or are interested in a template for strategic planning, this is one you can think about. Okay? Now, what's important about this is, well, let me just go ahead and go to the next slide.
Thank you.
Okay, we've talked a little bit about this already, the difference between outputs and outcomes, but I want to talk about a whole spectrum of the way you can think about what your ministry does. Because this is really important, I think, for strategic givers. The inputs. You need to be able to describe the inputs. That is what we use. So it could be a training curriculum. It could be the law. It could be the courts. What things do we have at our disposal to execute on the ministries? It could be the local church, for example, in the case of Josiah Venture. These are the things that we use. The next is the activities that we do. So we litigate in court on behalf of a Christian who's being persecuted, or we hold an evangelistic outreach, or we hold an artistic show highlighting the activities, the work of Christian artists. The next thing is the outputs, what happens. Now, this is where things start to get a little bit confusing, and you have to understand the difference between an output and an outcome. The ministry that I led, we trained church planters. So we used a training curriculum. We held the training. That was the activity. The output was what? The output was, hopefully, a trained church planter. That was the direct output of the training. Is that enough? Under the old paradigm, having a trained church planter was enough. But what's the outcome that we really want? We want more churches actually planted, right? Because if all we do is train church planters, and this is the risk for any training institution, if we only are producing students and graduates, then we're not really getting to the outcome, which was in this case. So, for example, for Victor, it might be
cases one.
Right. Now, here's the toughest one to measure. What's the impact? Now, for you, it may not be that hard, because the more cases you win, the more cases, the case law. Do you have a case law system?
No, it's a statute law.
It's a statute law. So it's going to be harder to measure that. But maybe as a result of winning the cases, more laws in the favor of Christians are written. In the English system, we would see that case law coming up. We would see more and more cases where Christians were, and that would be the impact. Now, the challenge with this is that most of us, we can't really... Let me just mention these. The more important it is, right? None of us just wants to be able to describe just our inputs, right? We want to be able to have good activities that lead to reasonable outputs that lead to outcomes and impact, right? We all want that, right? But the farther right we go, the harder it is to measure. Very few ministries, I mean very few. I mean, actually, this is something that Josiah Venture and we worked on for over a year. How do we actually describe the impact that Josiah Venture is having? The good thing about Josiah Venture is it's got good outcomes already because it's a mature ministry. But you know what? Most people stop here. This is where the big wall is. It's right about here. Some people actually can't even describe the outputs of their ministry. So if you're struggling then, more difficult to that. When you lose traction, move back to the left is the idea. So if you can't describe the impact, can you describe what the outcomes are? And if you can't describe the outcomes, at least be able to describe the outputs. And if you can't describe your outputs, then at least do you know what you're doing? Hopefully, if you're in the seminar, you've at least come that far, and you're probably somewhere in here. But this is where it tends to get bogged down. And this is hard work. Describing outcomes. Why is it important, though? Going back to our parable.
The donors are stewards.
The donors are stewards, right. And if I'm given the chance to invest in three ministries that are doing Christian artwork in the UK or in the world, which one am I going to invest in? The one that can only describe how many shows that they did? No, I'm going to invest in the one that says, and here are the outcomes that we see. And, rarely, here's the impact that we have. Because then you're speaking to the heart of a steward, because that's what the steward wants.
I have a question.
If you encounter a strategic donor that you want to have a relationship with, that you want to get money from, how do you get them interested in something that they're not interested in now?
Yeah.
The first one is pray. It's very difficult. So the short answer is, I don't know. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
To get them interested in something that they're not interested in now. So you really have to pray. You really have to be strong with your vision and really, I mean, for the specific example of Bulgaria, and I don't mean this to be offensive, the decision makers at McClellan, they don't understand the role that Bulgaria plays, for example, in all of Europe.
Yeah.
So if they have a European grant-making strategy, they want to know, well, why don't we have any grants going to Germany? They're asking about Germany, and they're asking about France, and they're asking about what they perceive to be the significant nations in Europe, not nations like Bulgaria or Serbia, unfortunately. So I don't mean that to be offensive. It's just they have a limited pool of funds, and so they say, well, why don't we have a grant in Germany? And to them, well, my response to that has been, well, yes, we don't have a grant to Germany. That's because there are things happening in Czech Republic, for example, that actually give us a more leveraged opportunity. So there are good reasons why I don't have to go to Germany first, and I can focus on Czech Republic. I just haven't gotten that far with Bulgaria yet.
Okay.
So
right.
We just have to keep talking, maybe is the short answer. So Victor's point for the recording is that if you have somebody who's got some experience at approaching strategic donors, hopefully you'll be able to tailor what you write and you'll be able to describe the division in a way that's compelling to them. True, but if I don't have a budget for Bulgaria, I don't have a budget for Bulgaria.
No, yes, sir. Bulgaria is the first country that stopped the child law, which is a new social engineering strategy that's coming from the European Union to destroy the family. It's like newly tailored Marxism. What happened was ADF joined in, and I was alerted to that. An organization, I wrote a brief, maybe not a brief, but a public opinion of how dangerous that law is and criticized it. People picked up on that, got into the social networks. The state was in planning, and UNICEF were planning to pass this law in November last year. At this point, after certain protests and so forth, this law is tabled. They're not even talking about it. 10,000 people got on the social networks. They realized what was going to happen because the law was explained in a way that its real meaning came out.
Sure.
So, and Bulgaria is the first country, actually, to table such legislature. And this legislature is active in Austria, France, Germany. It's like a big industry. So this social engineering is being tabled.
Great.
So it's a matter of maybe knowing about this.
Right, exactly. Okay, so Victor's point is that actually in the case of Bulgaria, Bulgaria is actually leading in the legal challenge to a law that the EU was planning to pass for all of the EU that would be detrimental to our biblical view of families.
And so
Alliance Defense Fund from the US was involved in some way through your local ministry in Bulgaria. And the law was tabled. So that's a great example of how you can talk about a success that then will interest a major donor to do something else with you. So maybe there's another law coming up, or in your network of attorneys, the next battleground for that very law is Austria. And you say, we need funding to stop this very same thing in Austria. It's also a good example of leverage, because Alliance Defense Fund in the United States is a very large, relatively well-funded ministry that Victor connected with in order to get some capacity that he didn't have to fight, some expertise and some funding probably, to fight this law that he himself personally didn't have the capacity for. So he's thinking about leverage. So if you put on your grant application, by the way, ADF has already given $5,000 toward this or whatever. Whatever. If it's $5, it doesn't matter. The point that ADF is there. ADF has given, let's say it's $2,000, and the full budget is $10,000. That's an example of how he's leveraged, and that's encouraging to a strategic giver because they see somebody else that they recognize like ADF is already involved. That makes sense? All right, we're going to keep going. Some of the things I'm going to give you now are just different takes on some of the things that we've already said, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on, unless you really want to spend some time, we can. So when we talked about stewardship, we know that God owns it all. He is our source for all of the funding that we have for our ministry. And the reason that I mention it again is because it's so easy to lose track of that. When we start talking about strategies and relationships and how do we get this money and that money, how do we meet, we just have to remember that this goes back to the balance again of God's part and our part. And I have an example of that from Scripture, by the way. Calling and vision are more important than money. Don't chase money. Follow God. I know when I meet with a ministry leader who's chasing money and not following God. And I think most strategic donors too, if they're tuned into the Spirit, they can identify when you're just chasing money. We had a guy, unfortunately, who came into our office several years back, and he was providing a presentation, and it wasn't going well. He wasn't listening. He wasn't answering our questions. We could just tell his goal was to get money. And at the end, my boss said, "Well, I'm sorry, so-and-so. We're not going to be able to provide you any funding." And the guy literally began to cry in the office. And he said, "This is terrible news. My whole plan was relying upon getting money from your foundation." So that was really, it was very uncomfortable because he never should have been relying on us at all to begin with. And we had to say no. So it was very clear that he had gotten his priorities out of order to the point that it had become an emotional thing for him, and it was very uncomfortable. So this goes back to the main point of the parable. Be faithful with what God has already given you. Being faithful in little is God's requirement to be being faithful in much. All right, now you're ready. Every project proposal must have five things. This is where we're going to try to be very practical, and we're going to come back to these things in a little while. The project must have a vision. It must have a plan. It must have a budget. It must have a description of outcomes. And the fifth thing is the so what factor. This is the question of impact. So if we have a vision for church planting training and we're doing the planting and this is our budget and these are our outcomes, we've planted so many churches, so what? And that is a question that I find myself asking a lot. And there's not usually a simple answer. So don't, when I say every project proposal should have that, I'm not saying that it's easy to describe the so what, but it's something that we need to spend some time on when we're doing a project proposal. Be honest with yourself and the giver about your capacity. This goes back to how many talents you have been given. This goes back to the organizational. Typically, we're starting with a smaller organization than our vision. But just be honest about that. Okay, this is going to be important. The next two things you're going to think a little bit like business, but I want you to be able to think about them because they're important. Who is your customer? Who is that? Who is you're really trying to serve in your ministry? And what is your business? That is, what specifically has God called you to do? What I'm getting at here is that a lot of times people have huge visions, you know, like we're going to save the world. And that does not speak to the heart of a strategic donor. The strategic donor wants to know what specifically you're trying to accomplish with a particular project. And be very clear, this next one, where you fit on the value chain. Okay, what do I mean by value chain? So there are very few ministries, in fact, none that I know of in the world, that can do the whole cycle of ministry. Pre-evangelism, evangelism, discipleship, leadership training, theology training, leadership development. I mean, it's not always linear, but there's a process that the kingdom goes through, right? So some organizations are really good at evangelism and pre-evangelism. That's, for example, Josiah Venture. And they're also very good with the other parts of it as well. But Josiah Venture, for example, until recently, they haven't been doing very much church planting. So there's the fruit of all this evangelism ministry with training young people in the churches. Where do those young people in the schools, where do those students end up? Now, again, Josiah Venture as an example, they have a very good system of, because the local churches are so engaged in the process of evangelism, that students can end up in the local church there. So I guess I've just disproven my theory that very few ministries can do all that. But Josiah Venture is actually an exception. Very few ministries can do every step in this value chain of the kingdom. So you need to know where you fit and who comes before you and who comes after you. The problem that I had with the ministry that I led that was about church planting is we saw a lot of church planter training go on. We saw some churches being planted. But what we realized is that those churches being planted were not fed by evangelism. So there was a lot of shifting of sheep. Christians, people who are already Christians, going to a new church plant from an existing church. But we didn't understand at that time that fruitful church planting meant there needed to be fruitful evangelism that took place before that. So if you're not doing evangelism, you're doing church planting, make sure you connect with an evangelism ministry to begin with. Or if you are an evangelism ministry, make sure you know where the fruit of that evangelism, make sure you have partners that are going to feed the people from evangelistic ministry into a church. And so this value chain, if you think of it in the way of business, there's just very few firms that go to the ground, pull out the iron, turn it into steel, make it into beams, construct the building, rent the building out. You know, I mean, there's different businesses along the way of this chain. It's the same with your ministry. And you should be able to describe that to a strategic donor because they want to know, they want to understand the whole thing. Other ideas. Learn to cast vision to those who are not in ministry or who are not part of your ministry. Be a blessing to your local government, local businesses. Pray for them. Ask them for help and resources. Sometimes we get so so caught up in our Christian world that we forget that the church was put in a community to be a blessing. This is especially true if you're doing some kind of community ministry. Make sure that you're blessing the mayor. You know, you've probably heard about people going to the mayor or to the city council and saying, we're a new church plant, we're Christians here, how can we pray for you? How can we be a blessing to the community? That is the way that the kingdom grows organically. We've talked about this question of God's part and our part. I want us to think about the story in Acts of Peter and the day that he's meditating on the roof of the house where he's staying. We won't go to the scripture, but can somebody tell me about that story, what happens there? He received a vision from God. Okay, what was the vision?
A sheet,
yes.
A sheet with four corners.
Yeah.
Gathered together, and in it he found many different kinds of animals and birds and everything to eat.
But not any that he could eat.
But not for him.
Right.
Eatable.
They were not edible for him because he was a Jew.
Yeah. Eatable for people, but not for him.
Right.
Yeah. And he embraced and he said, no, yep. I'm Peter, I'm a Jew. I've never done something like this. So God said, Peter, what I've cleaned, you don't call unclean.
Unclean, right.
So take everything from there.
Kill and eat.
Cut and eat.
Yeah.
And then
good.
Okay, great.
So we just had a very good recounting of the story. So we're going to do a secondary point again, just like we did the secondary point with the parable. So the primary point of that story is clean and unclean, right? It's God saying to Peter, hey, man, it's more than just these religious laws that you've been taught as a Jew. I am making these things now clean because, was he talking about food primarily? What was he talking about? People. Gentiles. Because then what happened? Knock, knock. Who was at the door? Yeah. To go to who? To Cornelius. And what does it say about Cornelius and his home that day?
He was a humble man and prayer man.
What happened as a result?
The whole house
was saved.
Including children,
that's right. So there's a lot of sub-points there. There's points about family salvation and whether that's really biblical and all. That's not the point I'm getting at. But the point is actually the story is not just about clean and unclean. It's about provision for ministry. God provided a sheet full of animals, but Peter didn't want to take them, even though they were provided by God. So he said, wait a second. These were provided by me. They are now clean. I declare them clean. And isn't it interesting? The next thing that happened was a knock on the door. Because not only did Cornelius and his family come to Christ that day, what do you think happened as a result? The ministry was provided for. Because Cornelius was a man of influence. He was a man of wealth. Now, what did Peter have to do in order to get that strategic donor engaged in his ministry? Yeah, he just had to obey, didn't he? Now, he didn't have a strategy. He wasn't writing down a list of all the potential strategic donors that he knew and putting numbers behind their name, saying, oh, I think Cornelius will be able to give 50,000 Caesarian forint or euro, whatever it was. It was all about God providing for Peter and his ministry. It was a theological point about clean and unclean, but the whole story, I believe, is one about provision as well. So that is an example of God's part and our part. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a thought about who some strategic donors you might meet, who they would be. I'm not saying you can't think about it, but I'm saying that is a story of how God brought the provision and all Peter did was obey. Now, do you think Peter was excited about going to Cornelius' house? He probably might have been uncomfortable with that. Paul had been called to be the apostle to the Gentiles, right? But not necessarily Peter. He was probably a little bit uncomfortable. Do you think you'll be uncomfortable the first time that you approach a strategic donor? Probably you will be. You probably won't know what to say. And you probably don't even know what God has planned, very similar to the way that Peter didn't know what God had planned for Cornelius. But it was, now we don't know this for sure, but it was likely a relationship that blessed not just Peter, but a lot of the ministry that took place in that part of the world at that time. So the point is to be available when God is calling you. Even if you're confused, even if you're uncomfortable, be engaged with people in your community in such a way that God can use them to fund, to provide for your needs.
I think more than this, if you're wrong.
Sure.
You need to be open to the voice of God, because sometimes...
Absolutely.
Most of the time we are led by our wishes. We just want to do something great or to become somebody.
Right.
So we try to accord, to fix or to fix the will of God over according to our will, you know?
Yeah.
And it is not like this. We need to be according with the will of God.
That's right. So the point is we need to be in tune with the Spirit. It says that Peter was meditating. Is that the word that it uses in that passage? I don't remember. But he was in the Spirit, I think is the way it says.
Praying,
he was meditating, he was in the Spirit. So the precursor, or that is what came before the provision, was what? Prayer. Being in communion with the Spirit. That is the posture that we need to have before the provision will come. Some people have asked me, you know, what characteristics do you look for when you're hiring a, quote, development director? Or, you know, most of your ministries are not big enough to have a professional fundraiser. But if you're ever in that position, they need to be people of prayer. That's the number one skill they have to have, because that's the way God provided in this case, at least. And, you know, actually, the New Testament is full, you know, Paul and Lydia, same thing. Paul was not planning, you know, to go to the river where he met Lydia, the seller of purple, with his, you know, list of strategic donors. Oh, Lydia, there she is. That was orchestrated. That was a relationship that was brought by God. You know, it's supernatural what happened in the New Testament. Doesn't it say in the New Testament that the gospel had even reached the house of Caesar? Right? Doesn't it say that?
When he was in jail.
Yeah, when he was in jail, right. You'll forgive me for not being a biblical, not having that much knowledge about the Bible, about where all those passages are. But that means that the gospel was reaching people of influence. So you need to learn to cast vision. That's that first point. Learn to cast vision to people who are not in ministry, because you never know who God will use to bless you. It's not necessarily people on the list. If you're a church planter, maybe it's the mayor giving you a place for your church to meet for less price. But who knows how God will use the mayor? Who knows how God will use the business people in your community? Okay, maximize your existing resources, especially people. Don't start with a big budget. See how much you can do without a lot of money. If you're faithful in little, be faithful in much. Don't assume that when the ministry begins, you need a lot of ministry to do it. try it to begin with without a lot of resources. See what you can mobilize in the way of volunteers, space. Get some law students who are Christians to help you write your briefs. Figure out a way. I always say it's much easier to do ministry without money than it is with. So make sure you're maximizing the existing resources that you have. Okay, this goes back to the other one. Lead people of influence to Christ. What's the number one thing you can do to cultivate new donors? Lead some people to Christ.
It's one thing to lead them to Christ. It's another thing for them to be rooted and grounded and remain faithful.
All right, let's talk about that for a minute. It's one thing to lead them to Christ. It's another thing to point is to disciple them, let's say, for them to be rooted in the faith. When will they give you money for your ministry? When's the best chance to give them money? When is the best chance in that process of discipleship for them to give resources to your ministry?
Number one.
Very beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if your point was they have to be discipled before they give, I think I would disagree with that. Because Cornelius didn't necessarily... Now, we don't have a verse that said that Cornelius wrote a check to Paul. But the energy that was there, and if you agree with me that the story is about provision, God provided, I think, with Cornelius in that relationship with Cornelius very early on in the relationship.
Yeah.
The point in saying lead people to Christ is that if you don't, then you're just competing with other ministries for the same money. When I come to a conference like this, people find out I'm from McClellan if they know what McClellan Foundation is, and you can see a little line form, you know. Can I have lunch with you? Can I have breakfast with you? Can I have dinner with you? Because they want to give me a project. Now, that's okay. That's part of the reason I'm here is to learn about what God is doing. So I'm not offended by that. But would it be better if you were to lead somebody to Christ in your own community who was a businessman or was a person of influence who had resources that they could give you? That way you're not competing with one or two sources. Because if you have to compete for the money from McClellan Foundation, there's not enough.
Can I
don't have a budget for Bulgaria, for example. So lead some Bulgarians to Christ.
Can I say one comment?
Sure.
Launch point will be, I'll approach you later.
There's something with a culture involved.
Yeah. Okay, so Victor's point was, yes, so, okay, we have two points here. Victor's point was, it's easier for me, where there's a culture of giving in the United States, stronger evangelical culture, stronger belief that Christians can be engaged in government and law and all of those things. I'm tracking with you. And Dimitri's point was culture has a huge part. Isn't it easier to pursue those avenues for funding? Well, yes. And I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying if that's all you do, you'll never have enough resources. It's a simple math problem. If we just added up all the needs in this room of the ministries that we have, I promise you the needs would be more than the budget I have for Europe, probably by a factor of 10. So I'm not saying you shouldn't pursue strategic donors in the United States. That's why you're in this seminar and that's why I'm giving it. But if that's all you do, if you don't cultivate local donors, the reason, it's not just about leading people to Christ. Okay, I'm not saying that's just it. I'm just saying that's got to be part of it, right? Because redemption, the gospel, is not just about going to heaven. The gospel is about redeeming our cultures. And generosity is the gospel. I mean, the gospel is rooted in generosity, the generosity of a loving father giving his only son. And so I think we shortchange ourselves when we think of the gospel as something less than that. I think generosity is part of the gospel. So it's a new space in your mind to think. It's not the only space.
No, I know what I'm talking about because, for example, I just identified our ministry in maximizing existing resources, especially people. We don't have the funds, so I told some people on our staff, you're going to raise your own funds, you're going to
become
a missionary.
Right, good.
So they did.
Good.
And that was a process that they grew in the faith through that.
Yeah, excellent.
But the issue is, how do we think ourselves on this end to be able to be thinking along those terms that this is actually what you should be doing?
Yeah.
And we should not be only, why wouldn't we do what you're suggesting to do to come for money. That's the problem that we need to, I guess, on both ends. I'm really happy that I hear it from you, because
yep.
this means that you also have that understanding that we have to look this way. But it's also, I must say, it is much easier to talk to
It is much easier, of course.
About. If I did not have the support and we didn't start raising money in the States, our ministry would not be what it is right
now. Of course,
here.
Yeah, sure, sure. So it's not an either or, it's a both and. My only point is that people automatically think the money is going to come from America because they've run out of resources in their local. Okay, but there's more resources there. And they may not be in the hands of kingdom people right now. They may be in the hands of people of the world. But those are God's resources that he wants to call out. Okay, so we agree, Victor, but...
We agree, yeah. Absolutely.
But, okay. Okay, so this goes to the bigger point that you were also making, Dimitri. Those of you who are pastors, you should teach about generosity, not just tithing. Okay, so it's a bigger... I think we make a real mistake when we say, hey, the churches in Eastern Europe don't teach about tithing. Right? Because I've been engaged in ministry in Europe for a long time. And the churches in Eastern Europe, I don't know why they always say Eastern Europe, as though the churches in Western Europe do teach about tithing. I don't think they do either. But they always say, the churches in Eastern Europe doesn't teach about tithing. I say, great. Because teaching about tithing is not what you need to be teaching about. You need to be teaching the gospel. And the gospel is a gospel of generosity. It's not about 10%. It's about everything that we have. And a cultural generosity, if it doesn't come from Bulgarian culture, or it doesn't come from Australian culture, if it doesn't come from American culture, let it come from the church. If you look at the graph that shows the generosity of nations per capita, the usual suspects are there. So America is among the most generous. Norway is among all the Scandinavian countries are very generous. Canada. But Australia and New Zealand are in the top 10. So it is there culturally. It's time for the church to call it out. If it's not in the cultural there, it's also, by the way, for legal reasons. We in the U.S. have a legal reason to give, a tax reason to give. We get a tax deduction. So fight for tax deductions for charitable contributions in your country. The governments are tired of being... You see what socialism has done to Greece, for example. What if the church had the resources to meet the needs of society? What if the church was teaching about generosity so that its people were being generous? I'm not saying this is an easy answer, guys. I know it isn't. I never said you're going to walk out of the seminar in 3 hours and have the answers to everything. But if you're a pastor, if you're teaching in the seminary, whatever you're doing, teach about generosity, not tithing, because that's the thing that will, that's what people, I'm not sure people get joy out of tithing. They get joy out of giving, out of being generous. I have a friend that says, I've never met an unhappy, generous person. Have I met unhappy rich people? All the time. I'm around a lot of rich people because of my job. There's a lot of them that are unhappy, except the generous ones. And you don't have to be rich to be generous. Yeah. I love it when he said, I've never met an unhappy, generous person. That's the message that I think we need to be teaching the church. All right. Okay, emphasize the solutions provided by your ministry, not your needs. So when I talked about the need earlier, I'm not talking about the need of your ministry. I'm talking about the need that's in the culture or that's in the ministry that you want to. Talk about your solutions. Don't say, I need 5 new staff people. Say, the need is this, and the solution we want to provide is this, and therefore we need more resources. So this is when you're communicating with a strategic donor. Talk to them in terms of solutions. Okay, be prepared to describe how you will use the money, how you will become self-sustaining, and your financial accountability. Strategic donors are wanting to know what the structure is that you have around your ministry and how you will be financially accountable. So for Cully, whatever accountability there is for solas, you can describe that to a strategic donor. It has a board of directors, or it's the elders of the church. Just make sure you know, especially for young ministries, sometimes young ministries, they just have a founder and a vision and a dog, you know, and that's all they've got. You need more than that. Okay. You need to be able to describe something that has some accountability to it. Or a cat. Yeah. Kelly, go ahead. Right. Good question. So the question for the recording is self-sustaining. That is, no, I don't mean that you have some kind of revenue generated so that like your art shows are not going to provide all the money that you need, but that you have a way for the strategic donor to see the end of his or her funding. So there's some sustaining that either comes from revenue that you might generate, ticket sales, or that might come from missionary support is actually the typical way that Christian ministries become self-sustaining. It doesn't mean they're not donations coming in. It's just like Victor said to his attorneys, his colleagues, you're going to have to raise your support. Well, that's a self-sustaining mechanism from within the culture, I mean.
Or your personal donors, they tend to be your self-sustaining.
That's right. Your relational donors, your personal donors are your self-sustaining. Now, having said that, I do think it's legitimate for ministries to have streams of revenue. If you're offering a service that's valued by the culture, charge for it. It doesn't have to be a huge amount of money, but charge something small. I'm not thinking of examples offhand, but there's a ministry, for example, in my hometown. It's a Christian ministry that helps the local university do freshman orientation. So freshmen, that is new students to the university, they come to the university and the university has to make this big program to get them all oriented to the university. Well, this Christian ministry said, hey, we'll help you. We'll even organize the freshman orientation for you in cooperation with these other ministries if you give us X amount of room space free of charge for the year. So they don't have to rent a room. They get a free room from the university, because they provide the freshman orientation services for the university. If there's something that you can either get in-kind gifts, we say in English, that is something for something, a trade, or you can actually charge for counseling services, or maybe it's a preschool, maybe you're, who was it that wanted to start a preschool or a school? Yeah. So tuition will obviously be part of what you're doing, but you're not just offering it for students. You're offering it for the whole public. Well, if you do that right, if the tuition is, that tuition can actually help fund other ministry in the community. I'm not an expert on Christian schools, but I'm assuming that could be part of the model. So it's not unbiblical, in what I'm saying, to receive from revenue for what you're doing. It's okay to charge services. Sometimes we as Christians say, oh, we have to give it all away. Well, no, not necessarily. There are some things you can charge for. Okay. Finally, we get to the question everybody on their mind. How do we connect with strategic givers? So, I don't have a good answer for you. I'm sorry. Why can't I give you the answer? Well, because it's specific to your context, to your culture, to the relationships that you already have. The one thing I can say is, a few things I can say. Number one, be creative. Number two, follow the relationships that God has already given you. What you need is to ask God for one relationship with a strategic giver. And if you can get that, then there's typically a path from that strategic giver to other strategic givers. Why? Because they tend to be the same kind of people. They tend to have means. Wealthy people tend to be with other wealthy people, because they want their children to be in the best possible schools and they can afford them. They move into neighborhoods where those schools are. They tend to go to churches where other wealthy people are, because those churches are in those parts of community. Find relationships that ask God to give you them, but then be a good steward of those relationships and find other strategic givers as a result. Now, a strategic giver does not have to be a person. It can be a church. New Hope, for example, probably the vast majority of the funding that you all have for projects come from U.S. churches, yeah, or Western European churches?
U.S.
churches. Okay. So there was a ministry, I did this seminar in the U.K., there was a ministry that was asking this question because they didn't think they could find any strategic donors in Sheffield. Well, that's ridiculous because there are lots of churches in Sheffield with wealthy Christians. But I said, okay, what is Sheffield known for? Steel. Sheffield was a steel city. I said, are there any other cities in the world that you know of that are known as steel cities?
My hometown.
Your hometown, which is?
Izhevsk,
okay.
Pittsburgh.
That was the one. They didn't think of Izhevsk. They thought of Pittsburgh. I said, what connections do you have in Pittsburgh? They said, well, none. I said, well, make some. Well, but we're not really connected anymore. That's not really a steel city. And I said, well, you're not really either anymore. Your education, their technology, but it doesn't matter. You know, just because you were once steel, because they actually are officially sister cities as well, Sheffield and Pittsburgh. So why not try to make some relationships in Pittsburgh? I said, I can't guarantee you that it's going to work, but it's an idea that you didn't have 5 minutes ago, right? So be creative. Think of ways that God may have naturally already connected you. And it turned out, by the way, that one of the women in that was a board member of that ministry, she was at a high-tech firm in Sheffield, a software company or something, some hardware devices. I said, do any of you ever travel internationally? And she said, I do. I go to San Jose, Silicon Valley, 3 times a year. I said, do you ever go to church while you're there? You know, I said, you know, this is a great opportunity that this ministry has given you. You go to Silicon Valley, which is one of the wealthiest places in America, and even more so now after Facebook started selling its shares yesterday. There are lots of wealthy Christians in San Jose. Why not visit a church there? Find somebody in the company that you're going to visit there. So just say in a meeting, by the way, I'm here over the weekend. I want to go to church. Does anybody go to church here? If God is orchestrating your relationships, I think it would be very interesting for a church in San Jose to be connected with a ministry that has people who are connected with high technology. You know, those are the kind of, so you get the idea, the kind of creative relationships that you need to make. Yeah, go ahead, David.
I think what is hard for a European, probably a Hungarian, what you just said, that I enter to a gratuitously to a church, find someone. This is just far away from culture. You never would do that. And
sure.
I always start my thinking and projecting my thoughts,
yeah,
about the culture. So I never would suppose or imagine that the U.S. church would work like that. So
yeah.
That's why we need to to know that from,
yeah,
you. But this is a cultural gap we cannot really overcome without a bridge.
Right.
Like anyway. So
right. Good. How do you make the bridges? Well, you've got to start with what you have,
yeah,
or you have to pray. Right. So that's,
yeah,
the point of the story.
Yeah.
Peter didn't have any vision. He didn't have any idea. He didn't even want to go share the gospel necessarily with a bunch of Gentiles, right? But God gave him the vision when he was in prayer and through that relationship. Yeah, so there's no cultural bridge. There's no cultural idea, no cultural understanding of how that can happen. Well, I can't solve that for you. But what I can show you in Scripture as an example is Peter and how he was connected with Cornelius. Why didn't God use Paul, the apostle called to the Gentiles, to hook in Cornelius? I don't know. I think because, possibly, God wanted to provide for the ministry of Peter and what he was doing through the family of Cornelius. It's nothing that you and I would have ever thought of. Mm-hmm. That's the point. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the point of connecting with strategic givers. It has to be a matter of prayer. And it takes time. Sometimes it takes years to do it. Hopefully, today is not the beginning, but for some, maybe it is the beginning. At least you'll understand more about the mindset. Okay. Remember at the beginning when we asked the question about, is fundraising ministry? And we decided that it was, because then the question is, how much time should I spend doing it? So somebody throw out a number, percentage of your time. 20%, says Cully. Who else? I have 20. Do I hear 25? 25. Join once. Go ahead. Yeah, going once, going to, yeah, you know what, I think it's about 20%. Yeah, yeah, congratulations, Colin. Yeah, I think it should be, yeah, I mean, that's, no, normally that for people is an overwhelming amount of time. They're thinking, you're asking me to carve out, let's say you work a 5-day work week, a whole day on fundraising? Well, if you see it as ministry, then yes, because it's ministry to you, it's ministry to God, and it's ministry to the strategic givers. When I was a support raising missionary, I had a guy who was a strategic giver. And he didn't give me $1,000 a month, but he gave me several hundred dollars a month. He was a very important part of my support team. And so I would try to call him at least a few times a year and just, you know, find out how he was doing. So I called him one time and I said, I'll change his name. I said, Joe. His name wasn't Joe, but I said, Joe, he has kind of a unique name, so probably should change it. I said, Joe, I said, you know, you've been giving faithfully. I just wanted to give you a personal update on how the ministry is going. And we talked for a little while. And then I said, hey, how is your heart?
How's your what?
Heart.
Heart.
How is your heart? And there was silence. And I could tell that he was uncomfortable. And I could tell that he was starting to cry on the other end of the line. Now, here's a guy who's got more money than you and I will ever have. He's got more connections, got a successful business, lives in a mansion, you know, nicer cars than you and I will ever drive. And what I was realizing was nobody was asking him, how was his heart? Because all the ministries that called, they just saw him as a bankomat. ATM. Bankomat, right? They just call, hey, how are you doing? Can you send more money? Now, I didn't mean I didn't ask him for money, but when I said, how's your heart? Nobody ever asked him that. Nobody at his church was asking him that. Certainly not any of the ministries that were asking him for money, and a lot. So fundraising was ministry. Now, what if I'd said, you know what, Joe, I'm just going to write you a quick note, an email, hey, thanks for the thing. You know what, I'd love to spend more time with you, but I don't have time to do fundraising. Because what ended up happening is we were on the phone for probably an hour because he was just pouring out his heart. If I didn't see fundraising as ministry, I would have never gotten that opportunity. Guess what? They didn't give any more. Now, you thought, oh, as a result of that, they gave more. Didn't. It didn't. They didn't give more. But that's okay. They gave the same amount. They were consistent. But it didn't matter. Because what God wanted to happen that day happened. It's not, by the way, because I'm some incredible counselor or minister. I just asked a simple question. So think of your time fundraising as ministry and as God's investment in you and your people and strategic donors. Okay, what is the role of the board of directors in fundraising? I'll just say, this is a question maybe I don't get too much in this context, but in other contexts, it needs to be significant. All of your directors, they need to be donors themselves in some way, and they need to be able to connect you with others. They need to be part of the vision. All right, now let's go back. Let me stop there. We're going to start our exercise now. But before we have our exercise, were there any questions about that last section since our break time? You all have been very good, by the way, about interrupting with questions and comments. It's really, you can't believe how hard it is to teach this material when nobody wants to ask questions. It's really boring and dry. So thank you for that. Anything else? Okay, we're actually going to do this. I want us to take, let's look at our time clock. I promised you that we would... Yes, very good. Robert has a very good question, and that is, how do we find out what a major donor is interested in? How do we find out if a foundation? So the first thing is to check the web. So our foundation, for example, we have a website, McClellan.net. We try to have very clear guidelines. But we have a peer foundation very similar to us, in Kansas City, and I can tell you the name, and you'd go on the web and you couldn't find them. Because they don't want to be found on the web. Because they don't want to have the avalanche of proposals. We don't mind the avalanche because we have a system for that. They don't. So even though we give about the same amount of money, they don't have the staff. So the simple answer is, as soon as you find out about a major donor, ask in your own network if anybody else knows them and knows what they give to. There is, for example, a in Czech Republic now. I can't give you too much details because it's confidential, but there's a Christian businessman who's about to sell a business in Czech Republic, and he's going to be become quite wealthy as a result of this business, I think. Well, I don't know for sure if it's going to sell. If it sells, let's put it that way, this Czech businessman who's a Christian will become quite a wealthy person. So his name is getting known now in Czech Republic as a potential man of resources. So he's getting invited to come and speak. You know, he's been now to the Netherlands and the UK because people have been hearing about his business. And but nobody bothers to ask him or to ask people. So in Czech Republic, you know, it's a small country, right? Are you in Czech? No, you're in Poland. Sorry. Czech Republic is a small, the evangelical community in Czech Republic is relatively small. Almost everybody knows everybody there. So if you find out about him, that's a good opportunity to ask some questions. What is he interested in? What has he been giving to? He gets invited to go speak all these places. What is he speaking about?
Vacation to
Bulgaria, to the Black Sea.
Family, 3 weeks.
By the way, you know what he's been teaching about when he's been asked to speak? Generosity. This is like the real deal, man. This is like Christian businessman, earned his money, legitimate way, in Central Europe, and he's talking about generosity.
So that's a lot of people pray you sell that one.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Okay, so you have to ask is the short answer. You don't have to know. You want to get as much information as you can ahead of time before you meet with the person. But even if you just have, sometimes I'll get a call and somebody, we call them in English a cold call. Somebody will call, just get my name and just call me or send me an email. They don't know me, I don't know them. I'm willing to listen to those because that's my job. But it really helps if instead of them just launching in to their thing, if they say, Lee, you don't know me, I work in such and such a country, I do this. Is this something that you think would interest you? Because I can save a lot of time, a lot of their time and my time. If they start with hospitals and they go on for 5 minutes without taking a breath about hospitals, not only have they wasted my time, they wasted their own time. You know? I mean, I say to people a lot, because it's not my job to say no. I'm not actually, it's not my money at the foundation. I just help find the projects. People say, are you telling me no? And I say, well, no, I'm not telling you no, but I'm telling you I know what our process is. And it's rigorous, and it takes time, and I don't think you're going to get a grant, so why would you want to waste your time going through our process? So again, it's not master and steward. It's steward and banker. If we're working together, this is why it's important for them to know that they're stewards. If we're working together, then we can be very frank, we can love each other, but we can also be free. That's why I don't like that foundation that I know that they don't give any of their information. Because they're thinking like masters. Now, I shouldn't say that because they're probably listening to this. They're great people. Got to be careful what I say on the recording. They're great people. I don't mean they think like masters, but if we're not willing to share information with each other, then I think we've missed a little bit about the steward and the banker.
Do you think the size of the foundation, is a foundation matters concerning project and foundation? Sometimes in business they say, big business and small business doesn't go together, and it should be both the same size.
Usually, yeah. Okay, so the question is, Robert's question is, does the size? The size of the foundation have to do with the amount of the gift, or what are you?
What kind of project?
Okay. Typically, you will. The short answer to your question is no, because typically you will not know what the size of the foundation is, like. Most people who have heard of McClellan Foundation actually don't know how much we have. And they don't typically know how much we give unless they've already received a grant from us. So that's why I told you earlier about different levels of involvement. And you should probably start those relatively low, like 5 or 10,000 euros. Because if it's a large foundation, they want to know that you have some entry-level opportunities. And if somebody says to me, well, can you give me 5,000 euros? I say, no, that's too small. I need a bigger project than that because I can't think. My budget is too big for 5,000 euro grants. But it's also too small for 1 million euro grants, right? Because I don't have that much. So you have to have different levels of opportunity. But you typically people won't tell you how much they have.
You mentioned before about mentioning if you've got a grant from another.
Yes. Yes.
Would you say how much you got?
Sure. You would say that. Yeah, I think banker to steward, steward to banker, you should be very clear. There are still a few foundations that will not allow you. There's one actually very significant foundation in the U.S. that will not allow you to use their name. And if you do, they won't give to you again. So they're very confidential. So you say, well, we have a large foundation in the U.S. that's given us a grant. They won't allow us to mention their name. And then I'll know exactly who it is.
Everyone should just do that then.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. We ask for top 10 donors when somebody's giving us a grant because we want to know about your fundraising mix. So if you have Foundation A, Foundation B, if it's all foundations, and I go, wait a second, what's the problem there? No relational donors. If I don't see some individuals on that list, I get nervous. If I don't see some churches on there, I get nervous. So ideally, you want to have individuals, you want to have churches, and you want to have strategic donors, foundations, institutions on there. Because each of them give for a different reason. And they give, some of them give more consistently than others for different reasons. Churches are great. Now, people say, ministries will say to me, we're going to the U.S. to raise money from U.S. churches. I say, okay, get ready to be frustrated. The problem with U.S. churches is, they're really hard to get money from because they usually have committees that have to decide about their missions giving. So you may meet, so somebody comes to Budapest on a short-term project and they may be part of the missions committee and you ask them, can your church in the U.S. give 10,000 or whatever it is? Well, the problem with that is that on the missions committee, all of the other missions committee members have gone to, you know, Nigeria or Australia. They've all gone on these missions projects and they're all coming back and they're competing for a small amount of money from that missions church budget. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't do it, but you should be prepared for it. It's a long-term kind of... New Hope has been doing it for 30 years.
Yeah,
something like that.
Many of our partners are actual churches.
Yeah.
Individuals from those churches that know us get to work for us.
I think you should have some churches, but it's not the risk... Their return on effort is not always that great with churches.
You said before that the strategical giver, they will be happy if after they will give you some amount of money, they will see as a resort or between resorts.
Yes.
Churches or other kind of resorts that that it's, how shall I say, it's saving people from hell.
Okay. Salvation as one of the outcomes. Yeah. Salvation is one of the outcomes.
If you experience something during
this. Yes. Well, I mean, McClellan Foundation, the one I represent, is very interested in evangelism, discipleship, church planting, leader development, and scripture development. Those are the five things that we do. So if you propose to me an evangelism project, and this is a good point you're making. If you propose to me an evangelism project, but you don't have any measurements, a way of measuring how many people will come to Christ, then it's not a very good evangelism project. I'm not saying that you have to do evangelism. I'm saying if you present evangelism project to me, like one of the brothers that's here, I mean, I can mention his name because you all probably have met him if you've been to the ELF, Raphael Adensenberger. Have you met Raphael? He's one of the steering committee members for the ELF, or he has been. He's a church planting leader in France. And I've known for Raphael for many years, and he proposed to McClellan a church planter training thing. And I said, well, how many churches do you hope will be planted out of as a result? And he said, I don't know. And I said, well, how many do you think? And he said, well, I don't know. That's not the way we do things. So I had to educate Raphael. This was 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 4 or 5, that if you're going to propose a church planting project, then there needs to be some estimate or some way of knowing how many actual churches will be planted. Now, I'm not saying that you have to predict a certain amount and that you have to have that amount actually. So I wasn't saying, Raphael, you have to have at least 30 and you have to plant 30 or you won't get funded again. The point is not the number. The point is that they understand, they've had enough experience in ministry that they understand what the result of the ministry could be. So I'm not saying that you're the Holy Spirit and that you predict 1,227 salvations. I'm just saying, what has the result been in the past? And if we give you more money to expand your ministry, this is a conversation that we've had with Josiah Venture. What is the possibility if we give you more money for more English camps, or we do more for Exit 316 in Slovakia and Poland now, how many students can be exposed to the gospel? And if we know that, and we know historically a certain percentage of students come to Christ as a result of those English camps or as a result of the Exit 316, then we can have an idea of what the outcome will be. Now, if I compare that with somebody else who comes to me and says, well, I want to do an English camp, and I say, okay, great, what's going to be the result? Well, I have no idea. We've never done an English camp before. Which one of those do you think I'm going to invest in? I'm going to invest the one that has some experience and can estimate for me. I don't stop writing checks if Josiah Venture doesn't reach the numbers, but you see, it's important for a steward to understand what the potential return will be.
Sure.
Yeah, you can't be
more
exact,
more, sure.
More, but you can be more sure. Yeah.
I think it's more being sure about the honest intentions and the capacity of the one who's receiving the funds.
Of the leader.
Just wanting specific numbers.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, so the point is it's more about understanding whether the leader really understands what he or she is doing. I think you're right about that.
Just repeat those five things that you said McClellan, as a...
Oh, yeah. So McClellan, just as an example, it's evangelism, discipleship, leadership development, church planting, and scripture development. Now, we don't do a lot of scripture development in Europe, but... the NBK translation of the Czech Bible. So Czech, up until about, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, had only two translations. Very ancient, like we would say in King James, but even worse. And then a 1970s edition that was not translated from the original languages. So a group called NBK Foundation in Czech, they translated the Bible into a modern dynamic equivalent, we would say. And McClellan gave the grant that helped them finish that scripture project. And as a result, ministry in Czech has really, all the ministries in Czech are benefiting from a modern translation of the Bible. All right, ready for our workshop time? All right, so we're going to start by writing a vision statement. Okay, now, vision statement. When I say that, it's a vision statement for the project, not for your organization. Okay, so think of a specific project that your ministry wants to accomplish and take a few minutes and write a vision statement for that project. What is it you want to accomplish? What need are you trying to meet? Okay, what need are we trying to meet, or what do we want to accomplish with the project? That's what I want you to write. 2, 3, 4 sentences, not longer. Something relatively brief.
Something.
Okay, yeah. So the question is, David is thinking about raising money for his own scholarship, let's say, for his own education. So in my mind, that is a primarily relational donor project.
Yeah.
But it never hurts to think strategically, even when you're doing a project that you think is going to be primarily done by relationships. So maybe your aunt... or your friend from high school, they don't care about the strategy. But maybe you'll meet somebody at church, an elder at your church who has a business. And and he's seen you minister in the church, and you say, hey, I want to be even more effective in ministry. Can I invite you to lunch? And so it will feel very relational. Okay, that's another point. By the way, you do still have to have relationships with strategic donors, right? So it's important that you have relationships. So it will feel very relational, but he might say, well, what do you want to accomplish by furthering your education? Mm-hmm. That's where these kinds of questions can come in. What I want to accomplish is this. Here's what I see the vision for my life will be. No, just we're going to go over the vision statement. So when you're done, just look up and so I know that you're finished. What we're going to do is we're going to read some of these and we're going to critique them together, okay? So we're going to get some input on that. I'm going to give you my input on what I would think as a donor. All right, who is ready, willing to share their... Oh, you're ready but not willing to share? Okay, Robert? Robert's going to read his.
Yeah, I think about the school, so it sounds like this. To provide good level of education with Christian perspective that will prepare children for responsible and Christ-like life in society.
Okay, so Robert is the founder of a Christian school, and the mission statement is to, one more time, listen carefully.
Provide good level of education with Christian perspective that will prepare children for responsible and Christ-like life in society.
Okay, so to prepare a good level of education, to prepare, say one more time, to prepare
with Christian perspective. The students for responsible and Christ-like life in society.
Okay, to prepare children for a responsible and Christ-like life in the society. Okay. All right, who has comments about that vision? I've already thought of a couple, but I want to give you the chance to... How would you critique what Robert has written?
It's broad.
Broad?
The vision and the mission statement, they're two different things. So we're talking about the vision, right?
Potentially, yes, depending on how you define them. Go ahead, keep going with your feedback.
But vision is good.
Vision is good.
If that would be the mission, then I would say it is too broad because you have to narrow, but probably we have two different terminologies between vision and mission.
Okay. So, the point is you're right, and I want to be careful that we don't get caught up in the technicalities between vision and mission, because you're right, vision and mission are different. More, I want to just know what you want to accomplish. So I think actually for purposes of a proposal, that's actually the idea of it is pretty good, because I think we can refine it more when it comes to the plan in this case. But for the purposes of this vision or mission, as long as it's not too broad and not too narrow is okay. I would think that from the size of it. Well, let me. I don't want to tell you what I think. Who else has some ideas? Okay, go ahead. About the vision. About just what Robert wrote. What do you have?
Well, vision. Oftentimes, I hear and I've written a lot of. Full of the vision. It's about where you want your ministry to those individuals or groups to be in so many, let's say, months or a year or two. Where you want to go in a year or two or 3 years. From point A to point B. Right?
Yes.
And mission statement is what you intend to do to go there. Right? The difference. Where you want to be in 3 years' time with that particular project. So,
yeah.
It should be kind of short.
So Dimitri's feedback is there needs to be some time element, time boundness to the statement. And I would agree with him. So that would have been my first piece of feedback to you as well. By such and such a date, have established a school, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to say, you want to give it some kind of time frame. The other thing is I think you, along with that, I think you want it to have, we want to know where it is. Because it's not. So what city are you in?
Sorry?
Which city? You're in Gdańsk.
Yeah, Gdańsk.
So do you want this? Do you want the school to be for the whole city of Gdańsk? Or just for a certain portion of it? Or for the whole city? Okay, so put it in there. So our vision is to see such and such a school by such and such in Gdańsk. And I would even put to reach what kind of children? Under-resourced? Middle class? Ethnic immigrants? Something. So it goes back to the question of vision and mission. How specific should it be? I think the breadth of it is fine. A Christian school, it's a project, it's a good vision. But it needs to be a little bit more refined in that you just need to give more specifics to the strategic donor to know by when and where.
It's like how many years of education will be provided.
You could put that in there, or you may say to launch, a way to refine the vision would be to launch a Christian school. So put a verb there to launch. Launch, to begin. Yes, to begin a Christian school. And or to buy, or you could say by 2014 to have established a Christian school. So you get the idea that you're in the beginning phase. It's okay to say to launch because that's a specific part of the project, right? I mean, you want a Christian school to go on for decades, years, right? But the launch of something.
But it sounds like two different projects. One
okay.
would start the school.
Yep.
The other one would to accomplish something with the school.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that's.
That was the point you were making, wasn't it? Or.
Not exactly, but it's the same question. What are we talking about? To start or.
To sustain.
Yeah.
To start or sustain. Okay, great, great question. Okay, so is the Christian school, is it the project itself? Or is there a portion of it that can be projectified, made into a project that would be more that a strategic donor would like better,
doable.
More doable for a strategic donor? And I think the answer is yes. So I think for a strategic donor, you want to say to start a Christian school, because if you say to have a Christian school. And I say, well, to have a Christian school, that could take 10 years, or that could take 20 years, or that could take, I don't know what portion of it you want me. So to say to launch, because then to launch has very specific time frames and expenses and costs related to it.
One project with two phases?
Potentially, yeah.
Obviously, we will need here a lot of work on detail.
Yes.
It's cool.
Yes.
It's a whole system.
It is. But I...
For example, something simpler, summer camp, we want to launch summer camps every year.
Right.
Like, what are you going to do with summer camp?
Right.
You have to explain. What will make children, teens come to know biblical truth, discipling,
yep.
playing, bonding, fellowship? What do you want to do?
Right. Right. So Dimitri's point is there are some projects like a summer camp, for example, as One Hope has, as New Hope has done many years. That is easy to make into a project for a donor, for a strategic donor. Some are not so easy. Summer camps are more easy than a Christian school.
It's very complex. Christian
right.
school is very complex.
But my point is that I think it can be done.
It can be done.
Because
sure.
the launch of the Christian school could be the project.
Yeah,
now, the reason that you need to have the rest of it available is because then the strategic donor will say, okay, but what happens after it's launched? Yeah. So that's when you have to have relational donors. That's when you need to show the board of directors. You also need to have some very good, this would be part of the plan, but you also need to have some very good statistics on education in Gdańsk. So ranking in the cities of over 1 million people in Poland, Gdańsk has the worst education, or it has the best, or it has
no Christian schools.
No Christian schools at all in Gdańsk. No Catholic schools even?
Oh.
No Protestant. No Protestant Christian schools. Okay. So, yeah. So, things like that. We need the donor needs to know what backs that up. So. Yes. Oh, yeah. Who wants to do a vision next? Yeah. Okay. I think. Go ahead.
The vision is to enlarge family ministry and counseling training by 2015 to reach every Russian-speaking church in Russia, Ukraine, Belarus.
Okay.
To... establish the family counseling in every local church.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, great. So I like that. That was, okay, read it again so I can repeat it back for the recording.
To enlarge family ministry by
215. Read the whole vision statement again. I'm sorry, you were doing that. I'm sorry, go ahead. To launch, sorry?
Yeah, to enlarge.
To enlarge.
It's already going on, but it's
okay.
Not that big.
To enlarge.
The family ministry and counseling.
The family ministry and counseling training.
By 2015, to reach every Russian-speaking church.
To reach every Russian-speaking church by 2015 in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus.
For training of clergy.
Pastors for counseling.
For marital counseling.
Okay. Yeah, that works for me. I mean, you'd have to figure out a way in English to make it flow a little bit better, but it has a specific place. Now, I think the relational donor would say, wow, by 2015, every Russian-speaking church in Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus, that is thousands of churches. So you might want to say, as a vision statement, that probably works. Now the plan, 3,000? Okay, but the plan is going to say, but in year one, we're going to do Belarus, year two. Okay, so, but I think that actually works pretty well as a vision statement. It's specific. It's clear. It's time bound. So yeah, very well done. Any comments or? Okay, go ahead. You want to read yours? Sure.
Giving solution to those needy people from Orada who receive the word of God preached on the street, for keeping their faith, and staying away from their addictions and be healed of them.
Okay. All right, so I think it's probably not as helpful for me to repeat the vision statement back for the recording, just to give you the critique. So the vision statement is about the city of Oradea. That's good. It is about
needy people.
Who
receive the word of God preached
okay.
On the street.
So people who've already heard the gospel through evangelism.
In evangelism. And staying away from their addiction. Because they return back in their...
Right, okay.
Very hard for them
okay.
to keep their faith.
Right, okay. So the vision is for transformation of addicts, really. Addicts who've come to Christ, but they have not yet been able to give up their addiction. And so there's a specific need to minister to them so they don't fall back into their addiction. Is that right?
There's one more. That was the mission or vision.
Yeah.
And the way, people, or an explanation, people who hear the word of God on streets or in churches are shaken in their faith by their different kinds of addictions,
right.
by poverty or their lack of resources.
Okay.
Therefore, they are going in their background and usually lose their faith.
Okay. Let's stop there. Now, we need to know how many people this is.
Yeah. That.
Do you know how many of this...
This is my question for you. Is it necessary to write down in my vision the number?
Yes. It is. It is important.
It is important. It depends on the capacity of our
yes.
establishment.
And it tells the strategic donor that you have done. So when I asked, when I said, how many churches are in Belarus? And he said, in the previous example, I said, how many Russian-speaking churches are there in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine? He said 3,000. So he already knew what his target was. You need to know what your target is. Because it's a different vision if it's 500 versus 50,000. If there's 50,000 addicts who've indicated a decision for Christ but are relapsing back into their addiction, that's a much bigger need than if it's 500. So the strategic donor needs to know.
I mean, I don't want to save the world, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there are more.
Yeah.
For me, it's... Yeah.
That's good. That's good.
100.
Okay, if it's 100, that's great because that's really good because that gives you the strategic donor then knows what your capacity is.
Is it necessary to be written in my vision?
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. Because again, the strategic donor is having to make decisions. He's got a limited amount of money. He has to make decisions based on what kingdom return he will get for his investment.
So giving solution to 100 needy people tomorrow.
Yes. Perfect. By what date?
By what?
What date do you want to have? By the end of 2013 or by the end of 2020? It's a big difference. If it's going to take me 10 years to reach 100 people, I'm thinking, something's wrong with that system. But if it's taking me a year, okay, then maybe that makes sense. I don't know, but you have to think about your capacity, your vision, what God is calling you to do, and you have to be able to write that in the vision statement.
Up to 200.
Yes.
2013
or whatever it is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
To begin classes after school for children that are weak in school. This is not only children from the church, but in general, this will give us opportunity to have contact with the children and have gospel impact, starting with about 30 children.
About how many?
30 children.
30 children. Yep, okay, that works. Do you have a date? Sorry, I didn't hear.
I didn't have a date.
Yeah, so you need to give it, because it's a project, it needs to have a beginning and an end. So make sure you include that. One thing that I just remembered while you were mentioning yours, and it went back to actually Robert's too, I forgot to mention it. Make sure the terms that you use can be definable in some way. So you started with good level of education. What does good level of education mean? Now there might be a technical term in Polish education system that if you get good, everybody knows what that means and it's a certain level. But I think you need to be more specific to have college preparatory or university preparation education, like gymnasium level, or what does good mean in that case? Or in the case, what does needy people mean? Okay, so needy is not as good a word as addict. Because if it's an addict, I know what that means. I don't know what needy means.
We all need.
Yeah, we're all needy to some level. Yeah, I've got a 10-year-old car. I need a new car. Well, not really, but I feel the need for it, you know? So be as specific as possible when
that's
it comes to...
That's tough to say that it's education with Christian perspective.
Yes, that was good. I would say, even better, I would say biblical perspective. Because biblical is even more specific than Christian. The reason why I asked you about Catholic is people could say, well, there's Catholic, so say biblical. Well, I'm not saying for those of you who are Catholic on the recording that Catholicism is biblical, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
All right. So you don't have to define the terms in the vision statement, but if somebody says, what does needy mean, or what does good mean, you need to be able to have a really good definition of what that is in a subnote or something. Because if you just say, well, good means, you know, good, the strategic donor is going to go, I don't know what good is. I mean, I come from Tennessee, and a good education in Tennessee is a lot less than a good education in other states, I can promise you that. So, does it make sense? Yeah, okay, go ahead. Cully?
In 4 years' time, a Victoria and Albert Museum is going to be built in Dundee. The city has been remapped physically and culturally, and the vision of Morphy Arts is to partner with the local churches to open a contemporary art gallery in the city that will enable the Christians in the arts to engage and to be established culturally in the contemporary arts scene at a time when Dundee's own cultural profile is raised nationally.
Okay, so too long, and it needs to be tightened up. But the point is, what I like about what he's saying is something is happening in Dundee. That's really good. Because Victoria and Albert is a very famous museum in London. So they're opening a branch in Dundee, is that the idea? So very famous art museum, beautiful place, by the way, if you ever get to go, beautiful courtyard. I've been there, could love to go back anytime. Something is happening in Dundee, so that's really good for a strategic donor to know. London is kind of the center of arts and culture in the UK, right? But Dundee has been recognized, for whatever reason, as the next branch of the Victoria and Albert, and that is a huge opportunity for the church. So the Olympics, or the expansion of the Victoria and Albert, or 16 public schools have closed in Gdansk, you know? Something that brings some, the law that would have changed the view of the family for the entire EU is coming up to vote. We need, you know, to do this. So some kind of contemporary urgency. So that's what I love about your vision statement. So we want to have the equivalent of the Victoria and Albert for Christians in Art to... Now, the challenge you're going to have... Read it again, Kelly.
Yes, so that's coming to city. The city's been remapped.
Right.
Culturally, ultimately, it's...
You got to tighten it up.
I've been trying to write it the whole time, but ultimately it's saying usually the church reacts culturally.
Yeah, great.
So it's saying we want to be established before,
yeah.
So that when you remap it and someone comes to Dundee and say, what will we go to? Oh, there's something.
Yeah.
And it's the church has got it already.
The church takes initiative.
Yeah, okay.
Would be a good word. So you're looking for good verbs, okay? Verbs are the key to making great sentences. Now, it's a challenge for you, those of you who are not native English speakers, which is most of us here, to come up with good verbs. But to initiate, to capitalize on, to take advantage of, these are the kinds of, to leverage, these are the kind of words that you want to use in English. Now, the challenge you're going to have with that is the so what, which we're not going to get to. But you have this Christian gallery established, so what? And if you can foreshadow the so what in the vision statement, so that Christians are recognized as artists equivalent of secular. I don't know what it is, but something like that to give a hint of the so what, so that the strategic donor knows what's happening. Okay? Go ahead, Peter.
To refocus Vineyard Australia as an evangelistic and church planning movement, this would have as its focus the implementation of a reproducing church planning strategy that enables Vineyard churches to have 60 churches in the next 60 months.
Great. Very good. Very good. Number of churches to refocus. I like that. It's a great verb, to refocus. It's very descriptive of what he wants to accomplish. So that 60 churches result in what time frame?
So that we reach 60. We have 34.
Okay, so that we reach
60 churches in 60 months.
In 60 months. Yeah. Okay. I think actually a better would be a year end. Of course, the question is when do you start it and so forth. But ideally, because the strategic donor would come back and say, well, when did the 60 months start?
Sure.
Yeah, so.
The 60 was to sell it locally.
Right, got it. Yeah. Now that's a very good one. So it really helps to have like really practical things like church planning, because that makes a vision statement really, really strong. Okay. All right, let's take a plan now. Now, a plan. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on telling you how to do the plan, but just take the vision statement that you've written and just give four or five steps that you need to take, that you know you need to take to reach that vision. It may not be all five. There's maybe 50. But boil it down to a reasonable 3 to 5 step plan. Okay? You're going to see quickly as you begin to develop a plan why understanding your goals and the time frame is so important. This is difficult. I realize you can't craft a plan, a real plan, in a few minutes. But I want to get the juices flowing, and I want to critique some of the plan steps so that you know what we're looking for.
This would be the plan steps for the donors to help him see the process of reaching the goal?
This would be the plan for you to execute the strategy.
It's for me.
It's for you. Yes. So you need a school board, formation of the board of directors, then securing the location, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Okay. Who's ready to share their plan? Okay, Robert.
First probably would be to constitute the school board.
Okay, good.
Or maybe the one of the next. Then develop curriculum for the school.
Yeah.
Classes. Then find adequate teachers. Then find proper location.
Yep.
Then advertise the school and launch the school.
Launch the school. Okay. So very basic plan. Begin with a school board. Next is curriculum. Next is finding qualified teachers. Next is finding location. And advertise and launch. Okay, yeah, those all sound like very good steps. Now, why would it be important to have the board before the curriculum?
That's the that's what I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Now think like a strategic donor. Who do you want forming the curriculum?
Say it again.
Who do you want forming the curriculum? Who decides what the curriculum is?
The board.
Yeah, okay. The board. Yeah. Right. I think that forming a board and doing it well is a very good step for any organization. Now, the thing about this Christian school is the project is the launch of the school. Now, most of you probably already have boards as part of your ministry, so you don't need that to be part of your step. But if you are forming something, launching something new, having the right board is a critical step.
So the board that you are thinking of in this context, do you think about board of directors or board of the school?
Is it different in your context? No. I think in the case of a school, the board of directors is the school board. It's one and the same.
We don't have boards
of directors.
In schools.
Okay, so it's the school board.
It's usually the principal that would work on the curriculum.
Okay.
Maybe with help of teachers.
Okay. So what does the board do in the Polish country? There is no board. Who is the principal accountable to?
Owner.
Owner? So it's a four... If it's a for-profit, what if it's a non-profit?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good question. So if it's a for-profit, so in the case of a school, if it's for-profit, then the strategic donor would really be an investor.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Because he would want a return back for, it wouldn't be a donation, it wouldn't be a gift. Mm-hmm. It would be actually an investment. Mm-hmm. And if it was a non-profit, like an association, that's forming the board, then it would be a donation, but then the association would have to have, I think, under EU law, an association has to have a board.
It could be that the owner of the school might be the Association of Baptist Churches in the area.
Okay,
India.
Okay. So then the accountable board would be the denomination.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Well, these are important questions to think through. So the only thing I would say about those steps is to make sure you have some dates attached to them. So you want to have the board established by such and such a date.
Uh-huh.
And you may want to have a sub-point about the qualifications of the board or the qualifications of the, you know, the denominational committee or whatever it is. All right, who else has a plan to share?
The idea is to reach every church in the Russian-speaking world, approaching them with a family ministry to be established at the local church. Because the life, if you ask a question in the congregation, who among you sitting here live in a family, either in your own family of origin or your own family of your husband or wife? You'll have 90% raising their hands.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely.
Yep.
Do people live separately. So the plan is, and the idea is to have the training from a Christian perspective, family, counseling, and ministry. So my plan would be to, I picked up on the board.
Uh-huh.
That's a great idea because I have a board of the seminary.
Yep.
Which are bishops.
Yep.
Who are...
In the clouds.
With their own needs in
yeah.
their own congregation.
Sure.
But they are already my clients.
Clients, yeah, sure.
Because they do have these people and they do have the need.
Yeah.
But to a degree, in my case, unless it is revealed, a person would not follow
mm-hmm.
the need of having the family council
yeah.
in the local church.
Yeah.
And I think theologically, I'm saying God has been doing family counseling before man sinned.
Yeah, good.
But it's a joke, yeah. But at the same time, we do need to have that. And I guess the forming of board by the end of this year.
Okay, form a board for the ministry. And then you'd want to talk about what kind of board members. So maybe some fathers. And some others, some lay people you want on the board, maybe who have been through counseling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a bunch of bishops.
And also the people of influence.
People of influence, absolutely.
Bishops are good
yeah.
in that sense.
Absolutely. I'm not saying no bishops. I'm saying have some lay people as well.
Yeah. Because yeah. the board should be the people of resources.
Right,
not
good.
Not necessarily financial resources, but resources of influence,
Yes. Good.
And then advertising through different mass media and printed material.
What about curriculum? Is the curriculum already there for training?
Yeah.
Okay.
The curriculum is there.
What about choosing the people to be trained?
That's
needs to be part of the plan.
Okay.
Okay, so if you
that choosing people to be trained, we don't have much of people who they're not yet flourished.
Yes, but so I'm telling you as a strategic donor, mm-hmm. when I evaluate a training ministry, mm-hmm. I want to know who it is, how you've chosen the people to train.
Oh, their own desire and determination of a pastor.
Okay, that's fine. Whatever it is. Because the thing is sometimes you can spend a lot of money uh-huh. and a lot of time training the wrong people.
Oh, no, that's not the case. No.
But you have to convince me.
Okay.
Because I've seen it dozens of times.
A
lot of boards, a lot of curriculum, uh-huh. no assessment, no process by which... So training has to include an element of how you know that you're training the right person. I love pastor recommendation, written essay that shows their passion, whatever it is, but there has to be, because if you don't have that process, then you will end up training some of the wrong people, for sure.
Well, they don't know. Spend their time, and it's not free of charge. So
okay, good.
Pay, and that's
good.
We don't have that.
So that, but just needs to be part of your plan.
Thank you,
is my point.
Thank you. And then advertising for all other kind of sources, and then traveling to the churches, presenting the issue, kind of
envisioning for the issue.
Yeah.
Uh huh. Advocacy, advocate for the issue of marriage.
That's it.
Okay, good. Yeah, okay, ready? Vladimir, go ahead.
I wrote Vision Like That through a training church planter, start 15 new churches in 10 years in different denominations.
Okay.
And plans to give together team from people who are interested in church planting and who are involved and they see whole Czech Republic.
Okay.
And then find good church planting training, someone who will train us. The best is from Europe.
Yeah, okay.
Then present it to the churches.
Okay.
Find resources for students. And next year start first church planting training.
Training, okay. You said present it to the churches was one of your steps. What did you mean by present it to the churches?
Okay.
The opportunity to train. Do you think you have that too late in the process? What if you were to go to the churches earlier and say, we want to develop a church planter training mechanism, church planter training ministry. Would you like to be a part of it and let them have influence in it? Or it's best to wait? What?
Team,
yeah.
And then find,
but what if they don't like the team you've established? So maybe it's better to ask them. I don't know. I'm not telling you that I know your plan better than you know your plan, but you just need to... So actually, that was a legitimate answer. In Czech Republic, people need the leadership of a team forming, and as long as the team is formed, they'll follow it. But be prepared to answer that kind of question. Why is this step before this step? Because in our culture, we do it differently. You say, well, we're not your culture. We do it this way. So establishing curriculum and choosing the trainers, all that depends on who... You know, the risk if you do it your way is that they won't like what you've chosen. So if you want people to buy in... The concept is if you want people to get behind something or be in favor of something, you get them involved in the process of developing it. So the only other thing I would say, which denominations, which years, be very specific about CB denomination, Baptist denomination, Pentecostals, We start with the Methodist, we start with the CB, then we move in why. We start with the CB because if the CB use it, then it has credibility. Or we start with the Pentecostals because they're the craziest and they're the ones that'll do it first, you know, or whatever, you know, have a good idea of what steps to take. All right? Good. Anybody else have a plan to share? Yep, Cully.
To approach the churches to get them on board with the vision, to locate suitable available space, to speak to the local council, to work out a budget, and so on, but that might come in a session. To ask the Victoria and Albert if there's potential partnership across the
Great, good one.
And to develop connections with other contemporary art projects.
Yeah, good. Good. So you've got leverage there. You've got the going kind of back to front. You've got establishing partnerships, finding out with Victoria, potentially investigating partnerships. You said, okay, so this is an important point about any plan that has envisioning. Okay, so the same with envisioning the pastors for the need for family counseling or envisioning pastors for the need of Christian contemporary art. The piece of envisioning that's almost always missed is establishing local ownership or finding an advocate where you are envisioning. So potentially you're going to have to travel to 3,000 churches or whatever number you choose. If you don't find somebody in that local context to carry the vision after you're gone, what's going to happen? They're going to forget. So, same with yours, Colleen. Anybody where there's an envisioning part of the plan, finding a local advocate is really important. Because finding a local advocate not only continues the vision after you're gone, but those are the people that can also become the leaders in your movement in the future. Because they have the passion for it, right? If they're raising their hands and saying, I want to be an advocate for this, then they're going to be the patrons for the gallery, maybe, or I don't know.
In the case of the school, would it be like a board of directors that can nominate another director?
Yes, anything like that. Or it could be part of your envisioning process, because you want it to be a Christian perspective, will be the local Protestant churches of Gdansk. So you will want to have an advocate in each of those churches. It doesn't have to be a board member, but it needs to be a parent. I mean, who do you ask? If I'm a parent, I have 3 school-age kids right now. When I want to ask what schools are best, I don't go to the school board or to the principals. I go to my friends and say, where are the best? What is? So you want to have some parents who are your advocates.
Yeah, how would you have it in the plan?
Part of the envisioning process, I would say, to envision, because part of a Christian school, I think, is you need to establish, part of the plan is you need to know that you have to have a certain number of students to launch. So your launch date is September 1st, 2014. By that date, you need to have 30 committed students, 30 families that are committed to sending their school. So it's the plan of how you get those 30 families committed.
So that's under advertisement of the school.
Okay. To me, it has to move forward in the plan.
But isn't advertising the school, isn't finding local advocate part of the bigger program called advertising?
No, I don't think so. I think you need to, I don't know anything about Christian schools, but I would think you need to have your core, committed core, before you advertise. It's like planting a church. If you just one church planter goes to a city and puts up a sign and says, I'm going to plant a church, it's much different than he goes and he finds a few people in that city who have the same heart and mind of him. If he can start with a group of 10 families and then advertise the church, then when new people come, they say, oh, this is something established. But if I don't have a core commitment to the school with 10 or 20 families, I'm not sure the advertising will do any good, because the advertising people will say, well, there's nothing here.
So you're saying that it would be good to have this kind of people from different groups of society, like different local churches, different
yes.
associations.
Closer to the beginning.
Yeah.
I think so. All right. Who else has a plan to share? Peter.
to budget and engage with the pastors, or engage the pastors in it, which would happen at a national conference. Recruiting potential planters, there would be internal methods for that as well as external. Internally, there would be, we have a growing under 35s movement, which would be a key focus because we want to move the whole deal young. The other internal thing is just to the local churches, and then there are externally a partnership with a group called the Canadian Push, which is a group very much about just selling the concept of church planning, and it seems to be gathering a
Geneva Push.
Yeah.
Hmm. Australia only.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
They're partnering with the Geneva Push, and also
that's a cool name, by the way. Yeah. Having a cool name is important.
Establishing a presence in Bible colleges and being a still a very well kept secret, right? And then training at the same point, we're establishing our own training arm, but also we want to work with existing colleges to operate at levels that we don't have, and put in place sort of internship as well as just training tracks.
Okay. Are you planning to train only Bible college seminary or non Bible college seminary as well?
Both, yeah.
Both, okay. So part of the plan needs to be theological. Good, good. So part of the plan will need to be, you said recruitment. I'm assuming you meant, you said you would have an assessment function in there as well.
Yeah.
Great. They have an assessment tool there. Great.
I mean, being out of USA is very strong also in that sort of area.
Okay, good.
So we'll feel our way with that.
Yeah. So the great thing about ministries like church planting and Christian schools is there are resources out there. There are lots of networks, the International Association of Christian Schools, that can have, they have templates and they have sample plans that you can use to establish these things. There are dozens of us. I mean, if you just Google church planting assessment, you'll just get, you know. So something a strategic donor will ask is, what networks are you connected to? Well, we're connected with Geneva Push. Oh, I've never heard of that. Well, it's similar to Acts 29 in the U.S. or something. Give some kind of hook, if you can, in the plan for a strategic donor from their context. You know, there's probably 200 or more different church planting networks in the U.S. If you know they're from Seattle, the strategic donor, then you know Acts 29 is something they're going to be familiar with. So, so that goes for you, Robert. People want to know what association, international association, will you be connected with? And so have that as part of your plan. Go ahead, Victor.
It's a conference. Actually, I didn't share a vision, but I was explaining. It's a conference to train pastors.
Okay. Oh, right. You didn't do vision. Right. Okay.
300 pastors and juniors in training conferences and Christian lawyers to understand and discuss church, the church state model.
Okay.
The post-communist in postmodern context, and have them engage in public Christian witness.
Okay.
Those are three conferences in three different cities, and the plan is in 3 years.
Okay.
One conference a year, 100 people at each conference.
Okay, good.
The plan is to fight in 5 steps, to organize the administrative team, because that's going to do a conference.
Yeah.
And then it costs and resources that we have. Second is to promote the conference and set up an information website.
Good.
And part of promotion is travel the country twice.
Good.
And meet with local leaders.
Okay.
I've done this.
Okay, right. Plan's already executed, but here, where's the plan?
It's to communicate and engage international and Bulgarian speakers.
Because yep.
It's both from a national perspective.
Yep.
What's happening in Europe and America, what's happening in Bulgaria.
Yes, good.
Four is organize the local church as a host and as a venue. That cuts and costs tremendously and engages the
yeah.
local church. And five is register participants, host speakers, conduct conference, and repeat.
Okay. Rinse and repeat. All right, a couple of things that you've done well there. Very specific time frame. The great thing about Bulgaria is you know who relatively small community to deal with. You know who the people are. One thing that he said that nobody else has said that I like so far is informational website. So part of your plan needs to be electronic media. Some you need to have a plan that says establish website, establish Facebook page, establish social media strategy. Now, some of your constituents are not going to be on Facebook, but some of them are. And if you want to establish a Christian school, you need to be very clear that you have some kind of social media way, because that's what people are looking for now in an education. Okay, sure, from a Christian perspective, but is it relevant electronically? Because it's a big part of education coming up. Establishing, envisioning for Christian, you know, the Facebook page or whatever for the gallery, or it's not a gallery, it's a whatever it is. Sorry, my brain is shutting down now near the end of the day. So I like the idea. You don't have to convince the strategic donor that you are Mark Zuckerberg, right? You don't have to be an expert at it, but you need to have some kind of electronic presence, because there's a certain portion of people that will find your ministry that way. And even if they don't find your ministry that way, if you come to the church and you say, this is the vision that I have, here's the website where you can read all about it, that's a way to equip your advocates, your local advocates as well. Make sure the curriculum, something about the church planner curriculum and some bios of the training team are on the website, so people can go, oh, I've never heard of Lee Behar. What does he know about church planner training? So they can go on the website and they can see a bio there. So good. Well done. Okay. Budget. Ready to move on to budget? Okay. This is hours and hours of work. Okay. This is days of work and prayer. I'll give you 5 minutes. You know, at some point we are going to have to cut this off because dinner begins, you know it. Well, as long as everybody's not leaving, I guess we'll keep going. Yes, okay, very good question. Peter's asking, I think the question is, are we putting in the project budget at this point or the organization budget? Is that what you're asking? Or... Yeah, okay. So this is the project budget. Okay? Not the organization budget, but the project, the budget for the project. And so this is where you can put in a line called staff coordination. This is where a line where you can put in portion of facilities used. This is where you need to come up with that kind of creative language for overhead, right? So electricity and salaries and all that. Nobody is against you putting them in there, just be creative in the way that you use the words.
Should we write in dollars?
No, and what the currency doesn't matter. What's your currency in Bulgaria?
Bulgarian leva.
Leva, right, leva.
So should we assess each point of the steps that we are going to take, how much
will it cost? Yeah, so ideally, the way that the plan leads to the budget, good question, Robert, is that there's a budget for each step in the plan. Ideally, that's the way you want it to work. So it flows. So there's a vision, and there's a plan to accomplish a vision, and then there's a budget to finance the plan. So ideally, that's what you want. So you'll need travel budget to travel to 3,000 churches. And you'll need some money for the website or whatever.
Educational expenses.
What does it mean?
To pay teachers to come.
To pay, yeah. So you've got cost of instruction or cost of. Are they coming from outside, or are they coming in? Are these Russian speakers themselves, or some outside?
Some outside.
Some inside.
Yeah, some outside. But we're not. Some are coming from outside. They come for free because they find their
yes
budget.
Yeah.
We take care of their needs.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
But you know, it's like a baby. You give birth and then you care for the rest of
your life. That's right. Yeah. So if you have an ongoing project, right? So, I mean, the truth is you could be training family counselors for the next 50 years for Russia, right? Since there's about 10 of them in the whole country, you know, whatever it is. So you have to give blocks. You have to say to launch the ministry, to establish the ministry, to expand the ministry. You know, there's these different segmentable times. So let's say you've established it, you've launched it, whatever it is, and you've gotten to a steady state. So for the last 3 years, we've been training, 50.
Exactly.
The next project is, how do we go from training 50 to 200 a year, whatever that is? So there are different parts of a life cycle of a ministry. You have a new project or a new expansion, etc.
The theory says all your budget has to be in three main parts.
Okay.
Academic, administrative, PR, development, broadcasting.
Yeah. It doesn't work for a strategic donor. You've got to the point is, in education, for the recording, your budget needs to be in academics. Mm-hmm. And what was the other two?
Education and PR. Academics, administration, and PR development.
Okay, so academics, administration, and then PR and development of the school and so forth. So I don't think a strategic donor will think that way. Because a strategic donor, of any of that, the strategic donor would be thinking more of the academics. Mm-hmm. But the strategic donor doesn't want to be funding administration. Yes. And the strategic donor doesn't want to be funding just your promoting your school.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you need to projectify, make something a project, a new academic program, which also has some administration and has some PR that goes along with it. But focus on something, some kind of project.
Where does this culture come from, not wanting to support administrative costs? I mean, it's very rational that in order to do something, you have to have these costs met.
Yes, but the strategic donor wants to know when they stop, what will happen when they stop giving. Because a strategic donor is not signing on to fund your ministry for the next 50 years. So if you say, I need the light bills paid for the next year, the strategic donor says, okay, well, what happens if I stop funding your light bill? Where will you find the money next year? So it's not that they're against the lights, but it's not typically what they fund because they're not going to be there forever. Very good question. So the question is, for staff coordination expenses, do we do it for all 3 years of the project or all 10 years of the project? Or just the launch phase, or just year one? Yeah, this is a long-term vision. Yeah, I would do it by per annum, annually. Yeah, so if I need staff coordination, so if it's a three-year project, I need staff coordination in year one of this, staff coordination in year two of this, and staff coordination in year three of this. Okay? So most people think of compensation costs annually, right? Yeah, so you receive annual salary, usually, is the way that happens.
Just like 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years I think would be reasonable. If you go more than 3 years, it's the further out you get, the bigger guess it is. Okay, the smaller the time frame, the more understanding you probably have it. If you can tell me what your ministry is going to be looking like 5 years from now, I will say, well, what did your ministry look 5 years ago? And are you doing today what you said you were going to be doing 5 years ago? And the answer is almost always no. So it's hard to predict what's happening 5 years from now. There's a very well-known ministry here in the U.S., here in Europe, that's actually working throughout Europe. They proposed a project to me for Poland, actually. And they wanted to, I won't go into the details, but I can tell you, they wanted to propose the Alpha course be launched in all 1,100 Catholic parishes so that each Catholic parish in Poland would have an Alpha course in the parish church. I said, how long is it going to take? They said 9 years. And I said two things. Number one, you're never going to get it in every parish because not even the Catholic church can get everything in every parish. And number two, there's no way you're going to be doing that for 9 years from now. What were you doing 9 years ago? Well, this. Were you be thinking 9 years ago that you would be doing this today? Of course not. So you can't think in terms of, you can't make statements like that that a thinking person won't challenge. So they had to go, it wasn't that I was against the Alpha course. or I think it's a great idea to get the Alpha Course in the Catholic parishes in Poland. I just didn't think it was a realistic vision. So now they have a much more refined vision. So that's the way you need to be thinking. All right. Ready to go with budget? Okay, good. Okay, what Vladimir did was very important just then. He said 70% will come from the churches and 30% will come from outside donors. That's really important for you to make the whole budget of the project so the strategic donor knows what the whole thing is, but then tell the strategic donor how much of that support will come internally, come from within the context. If you just say, I need 100,000 euro, the strategic donor is going to say, 100,000 euro for what? Well, how much are the churches paying? How much is the church planter training? How much is the trainee going to pay? Well, the training is free. What do we know about the value of free training? It's not very valuable because anybody can show up and do it. You want them to pay something. You want them to have a vested interest in some way. How much of the cost of the launch of the Christian school is going to come from tuition? So don't give the budget and say, this is all the donors that we need and the tuition is separate. No, I want to see the whole thing. Because if only 5% of the budget of the Christian school is coming from tuition, sounds like we got a problem, right? Because 5% from tuition is never going to pay the bills ultimately. I don't know what, because I'm not involved in Christian schools, I don't know what percent tuition should cover, but it seems like it needs to be like more than half. I don't know. So you understand the concept is give the full budget and then tell the donor where the money is coming from, where you envision the money coming from. Okay? You can even put ADF in there. We expect such an amount from ADF. We expect some amount from the Bulgarian school churches.
Well, the churches are providing their whole church the venue and the sound system for free.
Put the cost of it in there.
Yeah.
Put the cost of it in there and then subtract it out.
$450. I'll put that it's they're donating that.
Yes, good. And how much of the staff coordination expenses are being provided by support raising missionaries? So you put that in there as well. Staff coordination, the gross number, and then you subtract out support raising, missionary support raised. So you don't, in other words, you don't net the numbers. You gross the costs and you gross the revenues. Does it make sense? Because the strategic donor wants to know where the revenue sources are coming from. Okay? Telling you, if you do just that, you're going to be far beyond what most inexperienced ministries do for, I mean, because when I talk to a new grantee, I have to spend sometimes hours just trying to figure out where the money is coming from and where the money is going. And that's not fun work. So if you can do that work for me, really helps a lot. Be very clear about the sources of revenue and the uses of revenue. And try to quantify volunteer time. Put it in the budget if you can. It's not easy to do, but if you can do it, put it in the budget. Show it. Okay, who else has got a budget to share? Go ahead, Cully.
I struggled with this, but in terms of making it creative. So you've got this bit, the gallery rent, insurance, setting up the website, PR costs, advertising, wages for gallery director, curatorial staff, technicians, and then just kind of exhibition setup costs and materials.
It's pretty unexciting, isn't it? So the way that you the way that you can sweeten that and make it a little less just hard, I need number for salaries and so forth, is to see if you can work with a part-time director. So if you can put in part-time director costs or coordination by local art students. So students from the university can provide, maybe for credit, maybe not, volunteer hours to keep the gallery open or the center open. Anything you can do to leverage resources that don't relate to money and describe that. I don't know. I'm not telling you that it's possible.
Yeah. You couldn't do that without that money, but it all seems it really seems quite
administrative. Right, right, it does. Because you're not really producing anything. The thing that's produced... Yeah, right. Because what's produced is actually... Now, how does a for-profit gallery make money? They get a percentage of what the sale... Okay. Yeah, that's tricky.
Does it sound reasonable to write concerning school that to launch we need, let's say, $2,000? Well, if launch and have 1 year.
Yes.
It requires something like $50,000 or so. About 35% will be covered by tuition and, I don't know, 20% maybe by voluntary
yes.
or church or something. Next year will be probably 60% or
yes.
so covered by
Very good.
Our own expenses. Third year, maybe 90 or 80.
Yep.
Fourth year will be self-supported.
Right. Okay, yes. Before I forget, what about patrons, Cully? I know that sometimes galleries will have patrons. So that's... I know that's not in your expense budget, but...
And that's different from trust fund, is it?
It could be.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just know that I see when I go to an art gallery, which is as little as possible, I see a sign that says patrons on it. My wife is the artist in our family, not me. Maybe she could tell you how to do it. Okay, back to Robert's point. Robert's point was, if we show a multiple year budget, is it good to show that up front at the beginning we need more outside funds, but as time goes on the inside funds will increase? And I would say yes, absolutely. Any growth that you can show in increase of local funds over time for your ministry is really, really good. Especially if you can demonstrate some track record in that. You know, years ago, some of you probably know this, I was engaged in Eastern Europe. This is not exactly to do with this, but I think it's an important thing to understand. We would fund a church planter from the outside. We would say, in year one, we'll give you 100% of your salary. In year two, we give you 75%. In year three... 50, you know, you've seen this work probably, right? With missionaries, national missionaries. Did that ever work? If it worked, it was very rare that it worked. Why? So we fund a ministry in the first year 100% from outside. So there's a new church plant in Gdansk. So the church planter gets 100% of his salary from a church in the U.S., then the second year he gets 75%, then 50, and then by year five he gets zero. It's all supposed to be indigenous. Why doesn't that work? It works from time to time, but why in general doesn't that work?
From the beginning there was no local advocates.
Yep, there's no local funding from the beginning. Why else biblically? What have we already learned today? Why that doesn't work from the Bible? What's that? God wasn't behind it? Even more practical than that. It's the opposite of what the parable teaches. The parable teaches if you're faithful in little, you can be faithful in much. So we started with 100%. And we said, if you're faithful with 100%, we'll give you 75. Right? Didn't work. What if we... Now, I wish I would have known this back in 1993 when our church, when I was a missions pastor and we were funding, you know, these... I wish we would have said, okay, we'll give you 25% and see what God does then. And then, if God blesses and you're faithful, we'll give you 50. Now, I don't know how that works out because we couldn't give 100% forever. But, you know, you get the point? So, this goes to your point, Robert, which is there needs to be something, there needs to be growing ownership.
But you can say... Second year, 25% of the budget that will be bigger.
Yeah, right.
Again, 25%
of it will be bigger. Yeah, great idea. Yeah. So, the Bible is not impractical either. When we'll pay attention, we could have saved millions of dollars if we would have done.
He does say that the one who has will have more. Actually.
That's right.
And the one who doesn't.
Isn't that interesting? In the parable, exactly what the parable says. That's tough. I'm glad I'm not a theologian when it comes to verses like that.
He's just by his standards.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, this kind of thing that we're working on right now
should
be shown to a potential strategic sponsor.
Yes. The strategic donor will ask you for the budget.
So what should be our first approach?
What do you mean, your first approach?
I mean, I'm looking for a foundation that will help us to establish the school.
Yeah.
And I find, let's say, 10 that might be potentially interested in the International Biblical School. I write letters with what kind of...
Yeah, okay. So your first step is to find out as much information as you can about the donor.
Right.
So if they have a website, go and see what they require and comply exactly with what they say. Yeah, many of them will have requirements. Because the worst thing you can do, McClellan, for example, our requirements are very, very clear. We've been doing this for a long time. We ask for the things because we know what we want. I constantly have people saying, here, let me give you my CD and my DVD, and if you'll go to my... I can't use it because my shelf just, like, I have a strict no paper policy. Like, guess what happens to this when I leave Egg Air on Tuesday? I can't carry the paper, man. So the first step is find out what their guidelines are and comply with them. They have them for a reason. The next thing is, if they don't give you guidelines, this is a great place to start. If you can get this vision, plan, budget, outcomes, and the so what in 2 or 3 pages, perfect. If it's beyond 3 pages, they won't read it. If you can get it to 1 page, tough to do if you're doing all 5 of these things, your target really should be 2 pages. And you don't have to give, like, when I say, like you mentioned insurance, you don't need to give that much detail, insurance. You could say office costs and lump sum like that if you're doing an executive summary like this. Now, at some point in the application process, if they have an application, a strategic donor will want, you know, very good detail. But to start off with, they need to give a quick understanding of what you're trying to accomplish and whether they think you have the capacity to accomplish it. So what I would do, very practically, if I was in your situation, Robert, is I would find a school administrator in one of the churches in Gdansk. Maybe he works for the public school, and maybe he's absolutely committed to public education and he's totally against private education, whatever. Just say, hey, look, I know that you would never be a part of this. Can you advise me on things that I would need to share with a donor? And he'll say, well, yeah, you've got the curriculum in there, but it says nothing about the qualifications of the teachers. So he or she's going to be thinking as a school administrator about stuff that you and I are not thinking of because they have that experience. Find artists that have, you know, Christian artists that have exhibited. You probably already done this, but as an example, find Christian artists that have exhibited in secular galleries. Or find a Christian that works at the Victoria and Albert in London. Because there are some, I'm sure. It's a big place. Yeah. So, hey, man, come look at my plan. Get as much, this is part of the leverage. Leverage as much expertise as you can for free. If you know somebody at the Victoria and Albert in London who's a believer, that's gold. That's gold. All right, outcomes. Our brains are absolutely fried. And now you've got 5 minutes to craft your outcomes. There's not enough time, or there's not enough space, there's not enough... Welcome to ministry.
In case of educational, that would be a description of a graduate or what?
Yes, very good. So the output is a graduate. Uh-huh. The outcome is who that graduate is and what he does. So if the output is a trained counselor, the outcome is a counselor who
does the ministry at the local church as a minister.
Yeah, okay. Or is it just one local church? Or could they be tasked in multiple local churches? Could they have a specific number of clients that you expect them to see every year?
The outcome is what the vision is, isn't it?
What is the vision again? Tell me the vision.
It's to have every church with a family ministry.
Okay, but that's still an output. The actually having the counselor at every church is still an output, in my opinion. The outcome is an average of counseling 20 families per year in Christian marriage. And then you've set a benchmark by which you can measure whether the ministry, because it's one thing to train a Christian counselor, it's another thing for them to actually be doing the ministry, right? So set a benchmark. So the graduates, you don't get to graduate unless you've already counseled 10 families. And so included in the curriculum is the practical training so that when they leave, they have been challenged. Now, for the rest of your ministry, God, we are challenging you to counsel at least 20 families every year.
That would be my case.
Okay, so the output is an addict who has completed the curriculum or completed the ministry, whatever it is. The outcome is that addict staying clean for a year or 2 years or whatever it is. I'm not addicted to any substances that I'm aware of, so I don't know what it would be. I guess I'm addicted to sugar. I couldn't go a year without sugar. Whatever it is, whatever benchmark you think shows that they will not go back to the life. So here's a resource for you. Are you familiar with Teen Challenge in the U.S.? Teen Challenge? Okay, Teen Challenge is great at these kinds of things. So that would be an example of, because the strategic donor will say to you, what about Teen Challenge in Oradea? Does Teen Challenge have a ministry in Oradea? And then you say, no, but we want to do something like Teen Challenge, and this is the way we measure. We measure the same as Teen Challenge, or we don't measure the same as Teen Challenge because we don't know why. But where there are ministries that are doing like what you're doing, don't create your ministry in a vacuum. Find out what Teen Challenge is doing. If Teen Challenge is not in Oradea, maybe they're in Cluj. Or if they're not in Cluj, maybe they're in Bucharest. Or if they're not in Romania at all, maybe they're in Gdansk.
Yeah, in Serbia.
In Serbia, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. They aren't. Okay, so Teen Challenge is in Serbia, almost next door. But I think you have them in Romania. And find out the way they measure their outcomes and see if you can do it better. Almost every ministry that you all are, God has given you a vision for. And remember what we said earlier? You're not the only one that has the vision. You may be the only one in your context, as in the case, you know, of legal defense in Bulgaria. But ADF, Alliance Defense Fund, they've got years of experience. So you're already doing it. I'm just saying that's right. By the way, this is why we're at the ELF, isn't it? I mean, to network with people who have the same vision is that there's a whole Christian artist network here that you're going to be part of, I'm sure. What's that? You're leading it. Ah, good. The blind leading the blind, eh? But it's a great time to say, okay, we want to start this thing in Dundee. We have a huge opportunity. How would you do it?
This really is just a project for us. You know,
it is. I love it.
This is just a specific project
that
we already did.
But the Victoria and Albert thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. That's a great opportunity. Too bad McClellan doesn't fund anything in the arts. I would have to come for a visit, wouldn't I?
As for an outcome, the quality of the school will provide increase of at least 40% of number of students each year for the first 3 years.
Okay, I would call that. Okay, that could be an outcome. I would call.
I'm trying to how to measure the quality of teaching.
Yeah, sure.
If number of students might be a number.
Well, what you could do in that, like, boy. Problem is, I don't know very much about education, but you might want to say, as an outcome, you might want to measure the number of students that go to university.
Yeah, but this is probably primary and gymnasium school.
Okay, and yours is going to be which?
So they will go to, well, we would like to have later have high school also and maybe college. But
okay, you're going to start with primary school.
Yeah, we have not kindergarten on it.
So is it better for a primary school student to go to gymnasium versus a normal high school? Gymnasium is equal to high school.
Yeah, there might be, or maybe top 10 gymnasiums.
Yeah.
They, no,
Because then it's also a matter of cost.
Yeah.
They have to go locally, and it's also a matter of cost they have to pay if they want to.
Maybe the high school would be a measure.
What about an outcome related to Christian worldview, biblical worldview? So when the students leave at age 12, they can articulate a Christian worldview through a standardized test or through an interview, so that all of our students, you say, 10 things that all of our students will believe when they leave here. They will believe that God created the world, it's not the result of evolution. Or some Christian biblical worldview, that Jesus is the only way to God, not just a good teacher. You know, you will set a list of, this is giving the biblical perspective, and maybe that's the outcome. 80% of the students, 60% of the students subscribe to this. I don't know. It's tough. I'm not telling you that creating outcomes is easy. Have I said that? It's not. It's very difficult. But listen, it has to be difficult, because that's when we know the transformation is actually happening. If I'm just sending students to a Christian school, so what? I went to a Christian school, and I can tell you at least half of the students that were coming out of that Christian school were not Christians. So whatever mission they were trying to accomplish, if one of them was for the students to become Christians, they were not accomplishing it.
It's not a place for people to become Christians when they study. It's the church where people are discipled, not in the educational institution.
Right. So there's a big debate among Christian schools about what is the Christian school for. Is it for Christians, or is it not for Christians? So I see the position you're taking, but there's the opposite position, which is just as compelling. But to the point of our topic today, it's really important for a strategic donor to know which is your philosophy. Because the strategic donor may say, well, it's not to me adequate that they have these as the outcomes. Okay, so this brings up a great point, which is for strategic donor discussion. I mean, we're not going to tackle all those. But what's important for you to understand when you're speaking with strategic donors is know what your philosophy is about that and why. My philosophy is that people do not become Christian in Christian schools, and here's why. My philosophy is that the church is more than this, just registered by the state, and here's why. Now, that doesn't guarantee that the strategic donor is going to agree with you, but the strategic donor wants to know what you believe. Now, the truth is that I give grants to things that I wouldn't necessarily agree with. But I know the people behind them, and I know the outcomes of the ministry are ones that the foundation wants to accomplish. So it's not necessarily whether I personally agree with you or not. I don't have to agree with, you know, your view of a Christian school. But if you've made the compelling vision for me that why Gdansk needs a Christian school, then I'm going to give to it. I think that's a pretty compelling vision. If there's no Christian Protestant school in Gdansk at all, man, that's, you know, I'm not going to be real picky about whether, you know, your school has exactly the philosophy of mine, you know? So. All right, where are we? Outcomes. Who's ready to give outcomes? Okay, Kali, go.
So artists are given an opportunity to exhibit a collaborative network to further the career in the arts and influence the arts. It's a career opportunity. Church re-engagement in the arts. And then culture is going to change in response to the biblical worldview of the arts.
Really hard to measure outcomes. Now, would you be here? What if a strategic donor said to you, you know what? I have invested in an art gallery before, and the way we measured its success was how many paintings they sold. Would you be okay with a donor saying, or would you be okay with one of your measurements being a certain amount of sales? I mean, why not, right? But even contemporary artists have to sell, paint their work at some point, right?
Collectors, that's where the big money's at. You collect to get a name. Most artists are struggling.
They're bivocational. Yeah. I wonder if the opportunity, and I'm not advocating for this, I'm just brainstorming with you, but I wonder if the opportunity to the strategic donor is say, look, I can't measure whether culture is going to change as a result of this gallery, but what I can tell you is we have a vision to sell 20 pieces, 100 pieces, whatever the number is, in a certain year, and we believe that if we sell that many pieces, that not only are Christians going to be provided for, so I'm not asking you to provide for the artists, I'm just asking you to provide the space for them. Some Christian artists are going to be provided for, plus we're going to have a little bit of a percentage to keep us going here. And you'll know that people are appreciating the art because we're selling something that's glorifying God. Would you give? That's a better story than we want to change culture. Can you give to our gallery? You know?
Well, may I instead of something?
Yeah, sure.
I feel like it's really, I mean, the dichotomy of the American culture and the American mindset and the European mindset.
Yeah,
in
sure.
Europe, everything's provided by the government.
Right.
And that's where, in Europe, we expect the government to, it's a nanny state in the West and post-communism in the East. So I think that's where these measurements are really, you know, not offensive, but in a way just kind of like mind-boggling.
It's hard. Yeah, sure.
And I want to commend you for doing a great job bringing in that very necessary culture of the doer, which is the success of the American church. But at the same time, you understand that we struggle
with
socialist ideas.
Yeah, sure.
So anyway, and that's like...
No, you're right. And I think it's a fair critique, Victor, to say, hey, you're an American, you're not a European, you don't...
It's not a critique. I'm thanking you for bringing that perspective.
Yeah, but you can't swallow it all.
Yeah, at the same time, we deal with the reality that government supports art.
That's
it. They hold the knife in the...
Right. So we say you have to... You don't have to swallow... you don't have to swallow it all. You chew it up and you spit out the bones, the things that you can't use. Here's what I say. I have gone round and round with people about outcomes. Because I have very committed, godly people like you, Kali, who say, I just cannot get to an outcome. And I say, okay, fine. Don't do outcomes for strategic donors. Just do an outcome for your own calling from God. Because ultimately you want to make a difference, right? With your Christian school. You don't just want students to go through the Christian school and nothing happen. I mean, ultimately you want to know that you're making a difference. So how will Cully know that I'm making a difference?
I think it is a long term. I really do think it's a long term thing. And when I've spoken about this artist made work, and now it's an advertisement all over, and it came from an artist that did something like 20 years ago. And it's taken that long before now people are seeing this thing that they thought was crazy 20 years ago are now part of art, and they're not even thinking it's... So it's a long term. I just thought with, you know, strategic givers, and you mentioned earlier about the relational, someone that has a passion for the thing you're engaged in, that could also be a strategic giver who understands the arts. So you're not having to convince them about outcomes, a strategic giver who understands the arts.
Yep, great point. So an attorney is going to be a great strategic donor for your ministry, or a judge, or a politician, or some kind of community activist, because they know the value of activism. And a former church planter is going to be the one that values church plant. I guess most former church planters don't have any money, so they wouldn't be strategic donors. But Cully's point, which I think is a good one, is to pray that God from within your sphere, within your expertise, within your realm of ministry will bring people, former addicts who are now successful business people, who will value what you do, not because you can quantify the outcome, but because they've seen it in their own lives. That sounds like a strategic donor to me. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Okay, any other outcomes? Go ahead, Peter.
60 churches, which is 26 new churches in 5 years, or by such and such a day. Churches having a 25% conversion growth. Mindset and practice of modification by local churches that aims to reproduce every 3 years. 80% of new church
this a little bit from left field, but 80% of new churches led by leaders under 40 years ago.
Okay, very great outcomes. Those are kind of the classic outcomes because they're very measurable. Now, here's the mistake that people make when they have very measurable outcomes like that. So I read that and I go, wow, this guy knows what he's talking about. You know, for McClellan, that's like music to my ears, okay? That is what McClellan supports. Not in Australia, unfortunately for you. But here's the problem. Here's the thing we run into. Is I say, okay, Peter, you've got these fantastic outcomes. Now tell me, what mechanisms do you have in place to measure them? And what people often realize is that, wow, I don't have any way of knowing whether 25% of the growth is from conversions. Well, if you say you can do it, if that's your goal, you better have a mechanism. So a measurable outcome is one thing. Actually measuring the outcome is something completely different. So don't come up with a measurable outcome that you don't have a mechanism to measure. Okay? So what I like about what you said is the 80% under the age of 40 or whatever it was, because that's, you don't need a big elaborate system by which, but if you're going to measure conversion growth, then you're going to need a system by which to do it. There are, incidentally, churches in the U.S. that are measuring that. They're doing annual surveys. They're very nuanced. So they're saying things like, when did you become a believer? Were you attending our church? What other influences influence you to become a believer? Because they realize that even if they get somebody who's come to Christ, it's not just their church plant that influenced them to become a Christian. So it becomes very complex. But what they, but they're not doing it necessarily for donors. They really want to know for their own effectiveness as a ministry. And that's, again, that's what should really drive your outcomes, is you really want to know it. So Peter's saying partnering with NCD, which is Natural Church Development, comes out of Germany, I think. Christian Schwartz has created tools by which to measure church health and conversion and so forth. Okay, Vineyard as a denomination or as a fellowship of churches has established a benchmark. Oh, with NCD. Okay. Great, great. All right. So what? Does anybody have entered any? Now, what's going to happen with the so what is it's going to sound like a lot like the vision statement. Okay? This goes back to, isn't the outcome the vision? Well, not really. The so what is the vision. So that's all I'm going to say. Create a so what. And, well, I'll tell you this. The so what statement is the vision realized.
Is it measurable? So what?
Not necessarily. If the outcomes, yeah, so the question for the recording is the so what measurable? And I think the answer is not necessarily. It could be. If the outcomes were measurable, then the so what doesn't need to be. So they're not bright lines between these things. You know, there's an element of an output and an outcome. There's an element of outcomes in the so what. But the so what, if you've crafted the outcomes well, the so what can be much more conceptual again, because it's the vision realized.
Include a bit of the language of the heart as well as the head.
Sure. Yeah. I think you have, I think you have a lot more latitude, just like you had with the vision. I think you have a lot more latitude with the so what. It's what happens in between. If you've done that well, then the so what kind of writes itself. And I'm going to give you 1 minute. Now, we're just going to do a couple of these because we need to close in 2 minutes. Yes?
If I write church planting, movementing church, and new churches, starting churches, is it too wild?
No. I think the so what can even be a bigger vision than that. So that multiplying churches transform our society. I want the so what to be inspiring. It's only inspiring if you've measured the outcomes, right? But once you've measured some outcomes, then I want the so what to be inspiring. Go ahead.
My so what is that there are no divorces among Christians in Russian-speaking churches.
Wow. That sounds just a little bit pie in the sky, maybe, because there's always going to be some. But so that we see a significant decrease from 50% to 10% or whatever, something that's really inspiring but also not crazy. All right, we've got 60 seconds. Go ahead.
2013, 25 addicted people received Christ as Lord and Savior and were healed by their addiction.
Great. Love it. Specific, still specific and measurable, but a so what? The so what being that the gospel transformed their lives and they become an example to the addicts around them. That's the so what. It's not just about 25 lives. You know, you can do the 25 lives, but then say, what happens with those 25 lives? So that their families are transformed, and so that other addicts see the power of the gospel. I think I got you too focused on the outcomes. I want you to inspire me now at the so what. It's not just 25 families. It's what those 25 families or 25 addicts will do. They will transform their families, and other addicts will see them as an example. Who else? Victor?
Christian leaders and lawyers will engage effectively in the cultural debates and will influence the public square so the freedom of religion is respected and the gospel of Christ is freely preached and accessible.
Great. Wow. Okay, we're out of time. Here's what I want you to do. Everything you've learned today, I already said it, chew up the meat, swallow the meat, spit out the bones, get back with your teams. If your team is just your wife, then talk it over with your wife. If your team is a school board, talk it with your school board. If your team is David Robertson, then, you know, whoever it is, talk. This was a solitary exercise today because we're here as individuals. But if this thing is not looked at by a team or by interns or whoever it is you've got, let some students look at it if you're in student ministry. Let some church planters look at it if you're in church planting ministry. Let some artists look at it. Let some students look at it. Let some parents look at it. The people who are going to be part of the ministry, let some addicts look at it. Not just a bunch of theoreticians. Get the people who are engaging in the ministry and the target of the ministry, let them speak into the plan. Do this again with the right people. Thank you all very much.